70 years ago, the walls came down.
We're a very small pocket of deprivation surrounded by immense wealth.
I'm Polly Weston, and in my new series, I'm exploring the legacy of those walls today.
People should know that this did happen.
The Shadow of the Cutslow Walls on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Next Monday to Friday at 1:45.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Tuesday the 24th of March. This is Today with Amol Rajan and Nick Robinson.
The headlines today, the White House has said the situation in the Middle East is delicate after the US and Iran gave conflicting accounts of whether talks had taken place. The government is to set out plans for protecting consumers from rising prices, but is being urged to do more.
Also in today's programme, the UK's head of counter-terrorism policing will join us in the studio to explain why his team is leading the response to the arson attack on ambulances owned by a Jewish charity. As Enid Blyton's The Magic Faraway Tree gets the big screen treatment, children's laureate Frank Cottrell Boyce ponders why the best kids' books always leave the parents behind.
Everyone knows that parents get in the way. The first step on the road to adventure is to arrange for Mummy and Daddy to be, at the very least, lost at sea, or presumed dead in a plane crash, or burned to death when their mansion goes up in smoke, a series of unfortunate events.
And remember this from an erstwhile Christmas guest editor?
People were inspired by the chimpanzees, let's face it. It was a young girl out there with the chimpanzees. It was completely unique at the time.
Last night saw the presentation of the first Jane Goodall Awards. We'll be joined by one of the winners. That's all after the BBC News, read for us this morning by Vigi Alice.
The White House has said that sensitive diplomatic discussions are taking place about how to end the war in the Middle East, but that the situation is fluid. President Trump said yesterday that talks with someone he called a top person in Tehran had made good progress, so he would pause plans to attack power stations. Iran denied that any negotiations had taken place, but there have been reports in U.S. media of possible meetings involving senior officials in the coming days. Here's our North America correspondent David Willis.
President Trump said that Iran had reached out to the U.S. to negotiate after he had threatened to obliterate its energy infrastructure. Discussions, which began over the weekend, were set to continue this week, Mr. Trump added, involving a so-called top person within the Iranian regime. The comments were met with a mocking rebuttal from the Speaker of Iran's parliament, who called the suggestion fake news designed to manipulate the financial markets. But there are suggestions that messages indicating the United States is willing to negotiate have been relayed to the Iranian leadership through friendly countries such as Egypt and Pakistan. And the White House is not denying reports that a U.S. negotiating team, possibly including the Vice President J.D. Vance, might meet with Iranian counterparts as early as this week in the Pakistani capital, Islamabad.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he plans to continue attacks on Iran and targets linked to Hezbollah in Lebanon. Lebanese media report that the Israeli military has carried out a number of strikes in the suburbs of the capital, Beirut. Israel says its air defenses have dealt with a fresh wave of missiles fired by Iran. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, will today set out plans designed to prevent companies from unfairly raising prices because of the conflict in the Middle East. She is also expected to tell MPs about attempts to improve the UK's energy security and bring down bills. The offshore energy industry has called for support for North Sea exploration, warning against becoming reliant on imports. Our business reporter Daniel Thomas has more.
Oil and gas prices have spiked since the US-Israel war with Iran began, and that's putting pressure on household energy bills here. Offshore Energies UK says shocks like these underline the need for Britain to rely less on imported oil and gas and make better use of the resources on its doorstep. It wants the government to overturn a moratorium on new oil and gas exploration licences in the North Sea, but the government is pushing back. It is arguing that oil and gas is sold on international markets, which set the price for British bill payers, and increasing drilling won't take a penny off our bills.
The Metropolitan Police Commissioner says the force is investigating whether an Islamist group with links to Iran was behind the arson attack on a Jewish community group in North London. Sir Mark Rowley told an event hosted by the Community Security Trust, which monitors anti-Semitism, that all lines of inquiry were being pursued. He said 264 extra police officers would be deployed to protect the Jewish community in London. A long-awaited report on veterinary costs is due to be published this morning. The investigation by the Competition and Markets Authority is expected to include legally binding recommendations for the sector. The watchdog has previously said it wants greater transparency around pricing and around who owns a vet's practice. Jim Connolly reports.
The CMA says the veterinary industry is worth £6.7 billion, and anyone who's had treatment for their pet in recent years will know how costly it can be. Average vet prices rose by 63% between 2016 and 2023. That's well above the rate of inflation. Critics say that prices shot up after six corporate chains bought more than two-thirds of practices. The companies deny this and say customer expectation has increased, as has the level of treatment available. Today's measures are designed to bring down bills, but the British Veterinary Association says keeping vet practices open is costly, and the CMA's decision can't alter that.
An investigation by BBC News has found serious concerns within the UK's transplant services, with a shortage of resources affecting patient care and senior surgeons leaving the NHS to work abroad. Once a world leader in heart and lung transplantation, the UK is now falling behind comparable countries. Michael Buchanan reports.
The NHS does no more heart and lung transplants than it did 30 years ago, with the latest data showing that just 1 in 10 lungs and 1 in 7 hearts that were donated were actually transplanted. Experts have told File & Four Investigates that a lack of investment in new technology that might, for instance, provide more information on the condition of an organ or better protect it while it's being transported hinders NHS performance. Ministers say they've told the NHS of its responsibilities to urgently implement recommendations that would make transplant services fit for the future.
A number of postal workers have told the BBC they're being asked to move or hide mail so it looks as if targets are being met. Royal Mail bosses are due to answer questions from MPs today, weeks after frustrated customers complained of delays. The company has acknowledged the problems raised by the BBC but says the majority of first and second class post arrives on time. Voters in Denmark go to the polls today to decide whether to re-elect their Prime Minister, Mette Frederiksen. The snap election was called last month after Ms. Frederiksen received a poll boost for standing firm against President Trump's repeated calls for the US to annex Greenland. Adrian Murray reports from Copenhagen.
Mette Frederiksen has gambled that her strong leadership during an international crisis will help hand her victory. Following months of waning popularity, an unexpected Trump bump gave the Prime Minister a boost in the polls. But rather than geopolitics, it's domestic issues that have dominated the campaign trail, with the cost of living, pension reforms, agriculture and polluted drinking water ranking highly among voters' concerns.
Adrian Murray reporting.
Virgie, thank you very much indeed. It is 7 minutes past six. Time to say good morning to Ben Rich, who's got the weather. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Amal. Thank you very much. Good morning to you. A real range of weather out there across the UK today, depending on where you are. Across parts of North Wales, Northern England, it's just going to turn into a cloudy and a wet day with some heavy and persistent rain. To the north of that, a mixed picture for Northern Ireland and Scotland. Some sunny spells, but some heavy downpours. And across the south of the UK, actually largely dry with a fair bit of cloud and some sunshine. So let's get into the detail of all of that. Across the southwest of England, the southeast of England, eastern England, the Midlands and the southern half of Wales, a mostly cloudy start, some mist and murk in places as well. As we go through the day, the cloud will break a little bit to give a few spells of hazy sunshine, and it is going to be quite windy, in fact increasingly windy as the day goes on. Now for the north of Wales and for northern England, here a lot of cloud around, and that cloud is going to produce some outbreaks of rain, initially quite light and quite patchy, but into this afternoon the rain will turn heavy and persistent, and over high ground in North Wales and northwest England we could see actually quite a lot of rain coming down through the day, and those winds strengthening all the while. Now for Northern Ireland, quite a messy picture here. A little bit of brightness, some sunny spells, particularly up towards the north coast. Further south, more in the way of clouds, some outbreaks of rain, and across Northern Ireland we will see showers or longer spells of rain at times. And for Scotland, we start off with sunny spells and showers. showers and strong winds. Through the day, we'll see more clouds spreading from the west with some outbreaks of rain, although the winds here will actually ease a little bit. Quite a mild day in prospect with highs of 9 to 16 degrees.
Ben, thank you very much indeed. 9 minutes past six. Let's take our first look at the morning papers. Trump blinks first is the headline in the Mail, which says the US president has dramatically pulled back from the brink by postponing his deadline for Iran to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. The Financial Times believes surging oil prices and lacklustre public support are behind Mr. Trump's change of tack.
Most of the papers carry pictures of the arson attack in North London on ambulances owned by a Jewish community group. The Daily Express calls for the government to eliminate the ancient scourge of anti-Semitism, while the Daily Telegraph says the oldest hatred is rising again. The Guardian and The Eye highlight the fact that the security services are investigating whether a group linked to Iran was behind the attack.
The Times claims that efforts to renew the deal that sees the UK pay France for patrols to stop small boat crossings are being held up by the Home Secretary Shabana Mahmood. The paper says she wants any new agreement to make the funding conditional on how many migrants French police intercept. The Home Office didn't comment directly but confirmed it was looking for flexibility and innovation.
Calls for police to stop using live facial recognition cameras over fears of racial bias are featured in the Daily Mirror. It says Essex Police has already paused its programme after experts found it identified more black people than other groups. The force says inaccurate identifications were extremely rare and the software had now been tweaked.
The Times has picked up on the latest hot pursuit in Hampshire for Samba the sunbathing capybara. The 9-month-old rodent escaped from Marwell Zoo last week and was spotted at the weekend enjoying the sunshine near the River Itchen. She's still on the loose, despite a search effort involving drones and sniffer dogs.
The Daily Express is one of a number of titles that covers a study that could be designed for today programme staff. It has found that lots of small behaviour changes could significantly cut a person's risk of having a heart attack or stroke. And Nick, one suggestion from the scientists was getting an average of an extra 11 minutes of sleep a night. The paper suggests that readers ought to snooze their way to good health and asks, why not start now?
Well, indeed. People might be a bit surprised if we started snoring on air.
Did you get 11 minutes sleep last night at all?
A little more than 11, but not that much.
The producers on the show barely get any sleep before a program. In fact, they get none.
It is now 11 minutes past six.
Let's talk about what's happening in the Middle East with Frank Gardner, because there have been further strikes overnight, not least from Iran. Frank Gardner, our security correspondent, is in Doha. Frank, good morning from London. Just give us the view from where you are in Qatar. Is there any sign whatsoever of a de-escalation along the lines that President Trump seemed to be outlining last night?
Well, as you rightly say, the strikes have continued. Bahrain and eastern Saudi Arabia took some incoming drones. There were quite a few bangs and booms. And the Saudis have been tweeting about a number of drones they've intercepted. So the war is not over. But there is a collective sigh of relief, I think, that President Trump is not going to follow through, at least for the time being, on his threat to hit power plants. Because Iran said, fine, you hit our power plants, we will strike out effectively at the ones on this side of the Gulf. And, you know, this is one of the hottest parts of the planet. You need desalination plants in order to provide drinking water. It turns seawater into drinking water, and that provides, you know, water for millions of people. So potentially this was going to be a real problem here. It would have escalated the war and made life extremely uncomfortable. I mean, it's bad enough for those who are suffering the drones and missile strikes. We haven't had them for a few days here in Qatar, but, you know, there was always the fear that this could get worse, and it could still. But if there is a deal that removes the threat over the Strait of Hormuz, frees up the oil and gas that can pass through there, thereby lifting the kind of cloud that's hanging over the economies and over people's safety, then that's well received.
And Frank, how is Qatar? We spoke actually on the programme just a few hours after that attack on Ras Laffan, that hugely important source of Qatar's economy, really. How is the country coping with the aftermath of that?
Well, the man who doubles as Prime Minister and Foreign Minister, this is Sheikh Mohammed bin Abd al-Rahman al-Thani, gave a press conference alongside his Turkish counterpart, the Turkish Foreign Minister, Hakan Fidan, about 3 days ago. And he was, just after the attack, he was really angry and rattled. I mean, there was some condemnation of Israel for hitting Iran's South Pars gas facility, but really he was so cross with Iran, because he said, look, you know, we've we've had good relations with Iran. We share that big gas field with them. We send our ministers over there to Iran to have talks with them. You know, we consider them a brotherly nation. And what? We get this in return? You knock out our 17% of our gas-producing facilities for 5 years, that it's going to cost billions. That's not the actions of a neighbour. It can no way be justified. And although things have calmed down a bit since then, it is pausing the Gulf countries here to think really carefully about what their future security situation is going to be. Are the US bases that they have here, are they more of a liability than an asset? They were supposed to be there to protect them from Iran. But are they actually just drawing Iranian ire and fire? Because you can't change geography. Iran's always going to be there, whoever's in charge of it. And it's always going to be this latent threat over the Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz.
Frank Gardner in Doha, thank you.
It is now 6:15. A long-awaited report on the prices people pay at the vets is due to be published in a little under an hour's time. We're going to be hearing from the man in charge after 7:00. To set the scene, though, here's our investigations reporter, Jim Connolly, who joins us in the Today studio. You've been looking at this for a very long time, Jim. There is a huge amount of anger there at soaring prices, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, it's an absolutely fascinating subject in some ways, because what it does is it combines real human emotion with big business. Two-thirds of us own a pet. And the industry is estimated to be worth £6.7 billion a year. That's according to the CMA, who are looking at this report today. And anyone that does own a pet will know how much prices have jumped up. In 2013, we saw a big shift in who owns practices. It started to change. It went from practices being owned by your vet to practices being owned by big business. And critics say there was a big shift at that point, and that's when prices rose. Those companies deny that, but there is definitely something going on there that has driven quite a lot of anger from customers and for the CMA now to act.
The Competition and Markets Authority, as far as we know, the report doesn't come out for another half hour, seem to be saying more openness on prices. But another thing too, the suggestion that people would get the drugs for their animals online rather than necessarily at the vet's practice. Do the vets themselves think that'll make a difference?
Well, this is one of the interesting things. They've trialled that before. They've suggested that's come in today's report. Any vet you speak to is preparing themselves for that. The independent vets are incredibly nervous about that because that's one of their main income streams and that's how they make money. When it comes to will it work, well, the British Veterinary Association don't think so. They're very nervous about this because in one sense, what you're doing is creating, in their words, another anti-competitive market online, because the online pharmacies are owned 60 to 70% by two of these big companies that own the vet chains. So in some ways, what you're doing is pushing money from one pot over there to another pot over there, still owned by the same people. And the BVA are really critical of that. Obviously, the big companies that own that, they say, look, this is an open market, this is the future, and this is how people are going to get their pet care.
Brief final word, Jim. Is it much cheaper abroad?
Well, we've been following a couple of people who've been taking their animals abroad. And when you look at prices in France and Italy, it certainly is much cheaper. There are lots of reasons underpinning that, wages being a big one, and also energy costs and things like that. But it's really the wages that are being paid that are really driving prices over here.
We're going to hear a detailed report by you at about 7:30 and then from the Competition and Market Authority on what they plan to do about it. Jim Connolly, thank you.
6:17, an extraordinary week in global markets and oil, I think, this morning. Sean, is it back above $100 a barrel?
Yes. I mean, to be honest, if you only tuned in or took a sense check of the price of oil at this time of the morning, you might think back above $100 a barrel. It's been there for days, but that was how volatile yesterday was, with those words from Donald Trump about discussions between Iran and the US, meaning the oil price absolutely plummeted to below $98 a barrel at one point. But steadily overnight, as we've maybe seen some of that reaction from Iran, the words of fake news of those discussions and some questions about what it's all about, seeing the oil price tick back up again. Where are we at now? We're at almost $104 a barrel. But of course, on the ground in the Gulf, the issue with production, delivery of some of these most critical products still remains, whatever words are said elsewhere. I've got one of the world's biggest fertilizer company bosses with me. This is Yara International, the chemicals giant, who have said that attacks on energy production facilities, the blockage of the Strait of Hormuz, has meant that around 1 million tons of urea, which is a key ingredient for that fertilizer, is being removed from supply chains every week. Sven Holsetter is the chief executive there. Sven, can you just lay out the context of that, a million tons of it? What that has mean and what's changed in recent weeks?
Sure, and it's a very serious situation in the Middle East, and it has significant humanitarian consequences in the region, but it also spills straight into the global food system because fertilizer is not just another commodity. Half of the world's food production is a direct result of fertilizers being applied to the field of the farmers. And to put that million tons into perspective and using some calculations on what that would mean in terms of nutrients going into food production, when you lose up to a million tons of fertilizer production per year and calculating that into food, that could be up to 20 billion meals lost per week as a result of this situation.
Right. So, and is that impact being felt yet?
Not yet. And this is a big difference compared to what happened back in 2022 with Russia's war on Ukraine, where there was an attack on a food-producing nation as well. Here, it's going into the fertilizer, and fertilizer is being applied to the farmers across the world and in many parts of the world right now, and it will have an impact on the coming harvest, in the coming crop yields. So it'll take some time, and that's why it's important to raise the alarm right now on what could happen unless this is resolved quickly.
Have you seen any changes in the ability to transport through the Strait of Hormuz?
It's blocked. There's hardly any product going through the Strait of Hormuz right now, and the Strait of Hormuz is the most important shipping lane for urea fertilizer in the world. One third of urea fertilizer is going through the Strait every year, and there's an impact on product not being able to leave. There's production that is not where product is not being produced in Qatar. Iran is down as well, but you also have implications where when you cannot transport gas through the Strait of Hormuz, there's both a price increase but also a lack of gas to produce fertilizer in other parts of the world. So it's a very serious situation for fertilizer, and it puts additional burden on the shoulders of the farmers that were already in a challenging situation before this.
Are there any contingency plans that you're now looking at that perhaps weren't on the table a few weeks ago?
Well, we're doing whatever we can from Yara International to support the farmers in this challenging situation. And we built in a lot of flexibility in our system, and even both before the Russia's war on Ukraine, but also after, in order to be able to flex our production in this time. But it's also about supporting farmers using technology like with sensor technology, agronomic competence to help farmers on finding the exact right amount of fertilizer to use to minimize the yield loss, but also preserving fertilizer in a challenging situation.
But I guess that's a little bit of a longer term help that that if it's about technology and infrastructure and the money required to invest in that stuff. I just wonder more immediately, if a farmer isn't able to get the fertilizer they need right now, what consequences you're seeing of that?
Well, part of it you can implement right away, and the farmers are technologically advanced and they are using a lot of tools. So it's applying those right now with the latest information on both prices, crop prices, and so on. But it's also about governments supporting farmers, because crop prices have not moved up significantly since the start of the attack on Iran, and that puts farmers in a squeeze where input costs are increasing significantly, yet crop prices are not moving up at the same level, and that will have some consequences.
As you've had a bit of time to sort of digest this now, what has been the percentage increase of those costs for farmers when it comes to fertilizer?
When it comes to fertilizer, we're talking about approximately 50% price increase compared to before the war. In a matter of 3 weeks, about a 50% increase on urea fertilizer.
Sven Holsetter, thank you for your time this morning, Chief Executive of Yara International. Rachel Winter with us this morning. Rachel, good morning to you. I just wonder what you, when you hear Sven there talking about one aspect of the products being made in the Middle East and the ripple effect for farmers there and their cost pressures, whether you're starting to see any of this come through in actual price moves that the customers of those farmers and beyond are paying.
Not at the moment, but we expect it to come through quite soon. So tomorrow we have got the latest UK inflation figures coming out. Those will be the figures for February. So we don't expect to see the impact of the situation in the Middle East in those figures. But when we get the figures for March, we do expect to see an impact.
And Rachel, to give you full title, sorry, I didn't have that to hand, partner investment manager at Killick & Co. You've been watching these moves in the commodity markets very, very closely. What was yesterday like? We say it's back above $100 a barrel this morning, but what did the volatility, that fall and the rise again this morning, really mean for investors' views?
Oh, it's a roller coaster. I mean, to see such big moves in one single day is quite unusual. So if we go back to yesterday morning, oil was over $114 per barrel. We then had the social media post from Donald Trump about the negotiations. Oil came all the way down below $100 to about $97 per barrel. And then we had the comments from Iran saying perhaps there haven't been any negotiations. And now we've got oil back up to $103.
And was there any sense? I see there's a bit of reporting this morning in the Financial Times about bets and trades that were put in place ahead of Donald Trump's post. Have you seen that? When you look at the charts, what moves were made before his announcement?
Well, there was quite a lot of volume in oil contracts. So apparently quite a lot of people took out contracts that would allow them to profit from the oil price falling about 15 minutes before Donald Trump posted that social media post. So there has been some speculation about insider trading. We don't know if that's true, but hopefully there will be some sort of investigation into that.
Right. Would you expect that to be an American investigation, something the authorities here in the UK should be looking at?
Possibly both. It's possible that both sides have benefited, but it's arguably more likely that someone in the US could have had access to that insider information, if there was any.
And for us to briefly step away from the consequences of all this in the Middle East, to look at a big deal that was done yesterday for a British business, Huel, selling those, they bill them as meal replacement drinks. It's been bought by the massive French company Danone, the Activa yogurt, Evian water manufacturer. What's attracting Huel to Danone at the moment?
Well, so it's quite a big deal, actually. So Huel, it's short for human fuel. Back in 2022, Huel was valued at about $560 million. The deal has now gone through at over $1 billion. So it's a big increase in value in quite a short space of time. Supposedly, one of the reasons is that a lot of people are now taking these GLP-1 weight loss drugs. Those people are not able to consume as much food as they could previously in terms of volume. So what they do eat needs to be more dense in terms of nutrients. And apparently Huel fits that bill. So that's one reason why demand for Huel could have gone up.
That's the pitch. Rachel Winter, thank you, partner at Killick and Co. Let's check in with April LaRousse from Insight Investments, which is a big gilts government, UK government bond investor, manages over £600 billion in assets. April, head of investment specialists there. The cost of borrowing for the UK government bouncing around a lot with all these oil price moves. What have you seen in the last day?
Well, it's just been crazy. As you were talking about the oil price, I was thinking, gosh, that's what the gilt market's been doing. You know, we went from pricing more or less 4 interest rate hikes, and the UK Bank of England tends to increase interest rates in a quarter of a percentage point increments, to then pricing only 2 interest rate hikes. And about a month ago, we were pricing 2.5 interest rate cuts. So it has been really quite volatile in a way that we just don't normally experience in certainly short-dated UK government bonds.
Yeah, why is that happening? Is people literally changing their view by the minute on what is going to happen to long-term interest rates? For many people, this would be longer term.
Yeah, it's certainly a bit of interest rate expectations changing. I think the other issue with UK government bonds is they've become kind of a victim of their own success. You know, the market was looking really quite attractive relative to other similar government bond markets. You know, inflation was going in the right direction. The Bank of England was saying they were going to be cutting interest rates. And then suddenly the war breaks out. And people who have owned government bonds, who maybe that wasn't their natural place to be investing, want to get out. So you saw quite a lot of changes of how investors were viewing sort of the risks associated with investing in government bonds at all,
and
but particularly UK.
Just briefly, is there something about the UK as well when tough times come that we might be hit a bit harder?
Yeah, well, the UK is a bit more inflation sensitive, unfortunately. So these higher energy prices and potentially food prices will impact the UK more. And so the Bank of England may have to react.
April, you've wrapped it all up from the food prices, talking to the food fertiliser boss, to the impact that all that might have on people's interest rates in the months to come. Appreciate that. April LaRouche, their Head of Investment Specialists at Insight Investments.
Sean, thank you very much indeed. Never have we needed the diversion of sport more than this time. Garth, is it?
Yes, although there's quite a lot of detail and a lot going on in sport at the moment, particularly when it comes to the cricket side of things. Ben Stokes has said that the past 3 months have been the hardest period of his England cricket captaincy. He's posted an open letter to fans on social media after the ECB review of the Ashes announced that Stokes, head coach Brendan McCullum and the England team managing director Rob Key would all remain in their posts despite a 4-1 Ashes defeat over the winter. The BBC's cricket correspondent Stefan Schemmelt has details from the debrief.
The ritual of England cricket administrators explaining an Ashes failure comes every 4 years. This time, it was low on detail. No big announcement, just repeated promises to learn and do better. The Ashes tour was blighted with off-field incidents, so there are new expectations on player behaviour. Beyond a midnight curfew, those expectations were not revealed. Brendan McCullum remains as head coach. ECB chief executive Richard Gould said it would have been the easy thing to do to sack the New Zealander. The hard thing to do might be restoring the trust between the England team and their supporters.
Well, the managing director, Rob Key, admits that England will make changes in the way they approach selection. But head coach McCullum, who will return to the UK in May, won't be asked to alter his style.
There's no point keeping Brendan McCullum if you want him to completely change who he is. As soon as you lose authenticity as a leader, as a coach, captain, in any business, in any walk of life, you're done. So we don't want Brendan to completely change the person that he is, but all of us have to evolve. We have to get better.
The full Test Match special debate on the post-Ashes review is on the BBC iPlayer and is available as a podcast. And I have to say, it's fascinating to hear the full 20 minutes of Rob Key being interrogated by Mark Chapman and former England captains Sir Alistair Cook and Michael Vaughan. Arsenal continue the defence of their Women's Champions League title tonight when they host Chelsea in the first leg of the quarter-finals. There's commentary on 5 Live from 8 o'clock. And in tennis, the reigning Miami Open champion and world number one Aryna Sabalenka is through to the quarter-finals. The two-time Grand Slam champion Coco Gauff is also through to the last eight, as is the men's world number two Jannik Sinner.
Carthy, thank you so much. 20 minutes of Rob Key sounding like Rob Key.
Yeah. it's a good listen, I promise.
Yeah, I know. I can't wait. I'm looking forward to it. Thanks, Carthy. Throughout this week, Radio 4 finds out what it takes to be a politician today.
On BBC Radio 4, we're dealing with a lot of technological change, questions of economy, geopolitics.
I'm Isabel Hardman. In my new series, I'm asking if our politicians have the modern skills they need to do their jobs.
What happens in the Chamber of the Commons has become detached from what I think a lot of people think of as real politics.
I'll speak to politicians and those who advise and observe them.
People who have grown up on the internet and who have a very sophisticated understanding of when they are being made to make something go viral.
What do our politicians need to know now? With me, Isabel Hardman, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, this Monday to Friday at 1:45.
Time now, it's 28 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Amal Rajan and Nick Robinson and Vigialis. That's the summary of the news.
The White House says sensitive diplomatic discussions are taking place about how to end the war in the Middle East. President Trump said yesterday that talks with Iran had made good progress, but the Speaker of the Iranian Parliament said no such discussions had taken place. There have been reports that meetings between senior officials are planned in the coming days. Iran has fired another round of missiles at Israel overnight, and Israel has hit targets in Beirut, which it says were linked to the Iran-backed group Hezbollah. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, will today set out plans designed to prevent companies from unfairly raising prices because of the Middle East war. She's expected to tell MPs about proposals to improve the UK's energy security. Oil has risen back above $100 a barrel. The Metropolitan Police says it's investigating whether an Islamist group linked to Iran was behind an arson attack on a Jewish volunteer ambulance service in North London yesterday. More than 250 extra officers are being deployed to protect the city's Jewish community. A long-awaited report on veterinary costs is due to be published by the Competition and Markets Authority this morning. The watchdog has previously said it wants greater transparency around pricing. The British Veterinary Association says keeping practices open is costly. Accident investigators say they'll interview the controller who was operating at LaGuardia Airport in New York when a plane collided with a fire truck on the runway. The pilot and co-pilot died. In a recording taken from air traffic control, the controller repeatedly tells the truck driver to stop. And MPs will question Royal Mail bosses today about delays to letter deliveries. A number of postal workers have told the BBC they're being asked to move or hide mail so that it looks as if targets are being met. Royal Mail has acknowledged customer frustrations, but says the majority of first and second class post arrives on time.
Fidji, thank you. 26 minutes to 7 now. The country's top policeman, Sir Mark Rowley, has highlighted what he called the rapid and grave growth of Iranian state threats. He was speaking last night in the aftermath of the attack on ambulances owned by a Jewish community group in Golders Green in London, an area with a large Jewish population. Our special correspondent, Lucy Manning, was reporting from the scene yesterday and joins us now. Morning to you, Lucy. Sir Mark said it was too early, in his phrase, to link the attack to Iran. And yet counter-terrorism police are clearly investigating that possibility.
Good morning, Nick. Well, yes, the police are searching for three suspects seen on CCTV with hoods up, setting fire using an accelerant to the ambulances, which then caused massive explosions when the oxygen canisters were ignited. Counter-terror police are leading the investigation, even though it hasn't yet been declared a terrorist incident, and they're appealing for people to upload any CCTV or videos they might have. Forensic officers were seen yesterday combing through the synagogue car park because the ambulances were inside that synagogue area and the surrounding streets. And in this speech last night to the CST, which is an organisation that helps to protect the Jewish community, the Met Police chief said they were investigating potential Iranian state links that could have been behind the attack. He did say it was too early, but he talked about the concern of rapid growth in recent years of Iranian state threats in the UK, including 20 plots. And he said whoever is responsible for that attack, the impact is serious. And they are assessing the credibility of an Iranian-linked group, Tarakat Ashab al-Yamin al-Islamia, which translates as the Islamic Movement of the People of the Right Hand. They posted on social media yesterday saying they were responsible. They had also done the same after attacks on the Jewish community in Belgium and Holland. And the Met Commissioner said the British Jewish community was facing a volatile mix, he called it, where in recent years, it's been increasingly targeted by individuals, groups and hostile states intent on spreading fear, hate and harm.
Lucy Manning, our special correspondent, thank you. We're going to be talking at 8:10 to the man who is now in charge of that counter-terror investigation.
The time now is just coming up to 23 minutes to 7.
Oil prices soared, plummeted, then rose again as the markets tried to make sense of a day in which Donald Trump threatened to bomb Iranian power plants, dropped those threats as he said talks were underway with Iran, and the White House then sought to hose down suggestions that Vice President J.D. Vance was due to meet Iran's leaders. I've been speaking to Anthony Zerka, our North America correspondent, and asked him to take us through the last 24 hours of President Trump's decision-making.
It's been a wild day. I've been traveling with the president since last Friday, and we came into Monday morning thinking that this was the crunch day. This was the day that Donald Trump would have to either call in these airstrikes on Iran on their energy targets or have to back down. And it looked like the global markets were thinking that he was going to follow through with this. The price of oil was spiking. The U.S. Treasury's costs were going up. The stock market was futures were dipping here in the United States. And then as we were gathering at Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort in the morning, that Truth Social came out where he talked about constructive talks between the U.S. and Iran and temporarily postponing that ultimatum, that deadline by 5 days. And throughout the course of the day, as we followed Donald Trump first in Florida and then to Tennessee and then finally back here to Washington, D.C., he continued that upbeat tone. He said that the Iranians want a deal. There were hints of contacts between the United States and Iran. They wouldn't say who, but the, Donald Trump said that there was a 15-point plan that they had discussed and that there was a significant agreement. Now, the Iranians have downplayed this, but it did feel like Donald Trump and administration officials feel like progress has been made and that there is a potential now for some kind of resolution where there didn't really seem to be just 48 hours earlier.
The critics say he backed off again, he chickened out. Others who support him suggest, oh no, this is a skillful piece of signalling in a complex negotiation. One thing I know you will be watching with real interest, Anthony, is the suggestion that the vice president, J.D. Vance, would start to take a more important role than the men that Donald Trump has traditionally relied on for negotiations, Witkoff and Kushner.
Yeah, I thought that was fascinating, the possibility that J.D. Vance could be the front person for the United States in these negotiations. Because up until now, the vice president, who had been an outspoken critic of getting entangled in foreign wars, particularly in the Middle East, has been in a difficult situation. He has publicly towed the administration line. He has made limited comments to the press, but when he does, he says he supports the president, but he has kind of disappeared in the shadows for the most part. And I think there was a lot of speculation that he was uncomfortable with the aggressive move to start bombing, working with Israel and extend this conflict now going on to its fourth week. So the idea that he might be the person who steps to the forefront now, I think it does suggest that this administration does want to find some sort of a resolution. If you have the guy who's been talking about no forever wars doing your negotiations, you think he is going to be one of the ones to try to find a solution. And he also has a political interest in this. He is clearly considering running for president in 2028. And I think the last thing he wants is for, one, this war to wreck the American economy, or two, for it to drag on so that the American public, when they think about this administration, they think about broken promises when it comes to avoiding foreign entanglements.
Anthony Zerker in Washington, D.C., thank you.
It's 6:40. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, is expected to make a statement in the Commons today following a meeting of Sir Keir Starmer's Emergency Cobra Committee, where ministers discuss the economic impact of the war with Iran. We'll be speaking, actually, to the Energy Minister, Michael Shanks, at 6:50 about what might come of that statement. But just ahead of that session, the Prime Minister was in Parliament to talk to senior MPs yesterday in Parliament, as Alicia McCarthy now reports.
The Prime Minister was scheduled to appear in front of the Commons Liaison Committee for 90 minutes, and most of that time was devoted to the war in the Middle East. But he began closer to home, with condemnation of an arson attack in North London, which destroyed four ambulances belonging to a Jewish community charity in the early hours of Monday morning.
Can I start by expressing my disgust at this horrific anti-Semitic attack in Golders Green in the early hours of this morning? The idea that ambulances could be considered a target is simply horrendous.
Keir Starmer was in front of the liaison committee just ahead of a meeting of his emergency committee known as COBRA, and just a couple of hours after Donald Trump had taken to social media to say he'd postponed threatened strikes on Iranian power plants after what he called productive conversations with Iran. Labour MP Liam Byrne noted,
"Things are moving very quickly and the fog of war remains thick."
But even in the midst of that fog, he wanted to know if the Prime Minister could say how and when the conflict might stop. Keir Starmer hoped it would all be over soon.
To that end, I welcome the talks reported between the US and Iran. And to be clear with the committee, we, the UK, were aware that that was happening. And the immediate priority has to be a swift resolution of the conflict.
But that hope didn't quite spill over into optimism.
We mustn't fall in to the sort of false comfort of thinking that there will necessarily be a quick and early end to this. We have to plan on the basis there may not be.
But on the subject of planning, a Conservative, Sir Bernard Jenkin, wanted to know when MPs would see the defence investment plan for the equipment needed to ensure the UK's armed forces were ready for war. Ministers had promised to publish the 10-year strategy before Christmas, but it's not appeared yet.
I'm going to do this and I'm going to do it properly, and I want to be able to explain to Parliament where the money is coming from.
But it sounds as though you are at peace
Well, we are actually at war.
With respect, I'm clearing up the mess that I inherited from the last government. And
I dare say Winston Churchill had a bit of mess to clear up from the previous government. Margaret Thatcher had a bit of mess to clear up from the previous government.
But now Bernard Jenkin reckoned the situation was urgent. Keir Starmer told him,
"We are finalising the investment plan. That sits with the Strategic Defence Review.
It smacks of an enormous complacency.
Well, this smacks of the fact that for years there was underinvestment by the last government."
For many households and motorists, the immediate impact of the war with Iran has been a nerve-jangling rise in prices. Keir Starmer said ministers were looking at what could be done, but didn't know how long the conflict would last. Labour MP Bill Esterson thought that was all very well.
"You said earlier a couple of times that you don't want to alarm people, but people can see the prices going up now at the pumps. They can see it if they're on heating oil. People want answers now, Prime Minister."
The price per unit energy firms can charge for gas and electricity is capped and updated every 3 months.
"We're both looking at the end of June, but also looking ahead to the September-October position as well, which is when the energy percentage of energy being used goes up considerably for very obvious reasons."
The government has committed to spending more of the UK's national income on defence. The Labour chair of the committee, Dame Meg Hillier, wondered,
"Do you think that the public understand the real trade-offs that will have to be made if there's more investment in defence?"
The Prime Minister agreed it was something that needed to be talked about.
"When you say to people, should we spend more on defence, the answer tends to be yes. When you then say, does that mean we should spend less on something else, it becomes more nuanced. Answer. That's not just the public, I find that in Parliament as well quite frequently."
One person Keir Starmer has been talking to is Donald Trump. The pair spoke on Sunday, but Meg Hillier reckoned it couldn't be easy dealing with the US President.
"Who does make some quite rude comments about the UK one day and sometimes is, is supportive of the UK. You're dealing, it seems like, different presidents on different days of the week."
Well, the Prime Minister dodged the opportunity to criticise the President, instead insisting his job was to focus on the British national interest.
Well, that was Alicia McCarthy reporting on yesterday in Parliament. And yes, we'll come back to those issues throughout the programme, including at 10 to 8. Let's turn back to the Middle East, because Iran and Israel have continued to exchange strikes overnight. Iran fired a salvo of missiles at central and southern Israel overnight that caused damage in central Tel Aviv. And while President Donald Trump has said there will be, that there had been very good talks to end the war, interestingly, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has now vowed that Israel will continue with its strikes. Let's speak to James Waterhouse, our foreign correspondent. James, this is, it's very hard to know because of the fluctuations, to put it mildly, in Trump's position. It's hard to know, isn't it, whether this is actually the beginnings of a division between Israel and America. But it's clear that, that Benjamin Netanyahu isn't going to relent anytime soon.
That's as so much, Amol, is clear. Benjamin Netanyahu, as you say, he said, "We will pursue our interests no matter what. We will keep hitting Iran and we will keep hitting Hezbollah in southern Lebanon." And despite the political to-ings and fro-ings we're seeing from the White House as it gets drawn into the Strait of Hormuz, Israel is ploughing on. Benjamin Netanyahu is ruthlessly focused in this military partnership of trying to degrade both Iran and Hezbollah as much as possible. And this is the aerial dynamic we find ourselves in. Cities like Jerusalem, where I am, you'll hear the air defences go off as it's effective. Air defences intercept missiles. And in Tel Aviv, we're now seeing scenes of rescue crews trying to get people out of an air raid shelter. There's a large-looking crater in a street with blast damage on the surrounding buildings. Iran is willing and able to respond where it can with long-range ballistic missiles that can reach here in as little as a minute and a half. But, you know, we're seeing Israel's ground operation expand in southern Lebanon. We've seen it over the past few days take out key bridges, engage in close combat fighting. We've seen southern Beirut-y suburbs struck once more. So as far as Israel's concerned, it's quite simple. There is very little change of course that we can see.
And, you know, one criticism that's been made, James, of the American position is evolving accounts of what the war aims are. Israel's been more sort of clear about its war aims in one respect, in which it's been consistent, which is the elimination of Iran's nuclear program and the elimination of ballistic missiles. Is there any incentive for Israel to kind of de-escalate until those aims have been achieved?
you certainly don't detect that, because I think, as I say, as America is forced to focus on the Strait of Hormuz, as these reports of, you know, sending more American troops continue to grow as it tries to unblock, as Iran demonstrates that it can indeed control the Strait by targeting ships with, you know, cheap drones. I think for Israel, it's a continuation of its window to degrade its enemies as much as possible. Now, you're right. I think what's striking is Benjamin Netanyahu is talking, you know, he says a regime change is unlikely. But he, along with so many of Donald Trump's allies, is having to choose his words carefully. He says he trusts Donald Trump in securing a peace deal that will protect our interests. In Hebrew, on one moment, he said this war might last a long time. In English, he might say, it'll be over sooner than people think. But I think, you know, who knows what the tacit agreements are between the White House and Israel are. But you can see that he is seeing this as a war he's wanted to undertake for some time, and he is doing so ruthlessly. And I think as long as Americans' objectives continue to fluctuate, he is happy to degrade Iran and Hezbollah as much as possible, and see where he's at, you suspect, once America decides it's had enough.
And just give us a recap, if you would, James, of the damage that Israel is taking at the moment, because this is not a completely asymmetric war. There is a huge amount of incoming, and as you say, that Tel Aviv, in fact, I'm just reading now, that central Tel Aviv itself has taken some severe damage as well.
Yeah, we're getting some reports. I think reportedly there are four different impact sites as a salvo of ballistic missiles flew in overnight. Some officials are saying that the Iranians are using cluster munitions, which spread smaller explosives over a large area. And the pictures seem to show several vehicles on fire, a large crater, which suggests a direct hit. But I've got to say, you know, the air defenses are extremely effective, certainly on the Israeli side, but they do have an effect over time. They disrupt people's lives. They do have to take shelter. And it just shows that despite the huge geographical area this war is being operated within, there is no escaping it.
James Woodhouse, our foreign correspondent, thank you very much indeed.
It is now 10 to 7. Palliative and end-of-life care is understaffed and undervalued. That, at least, is the verdict of MPs on Westminster's Health and Social Care Committee. They've been investigating standards of care in the NHS in England. We're joined by the chair of the committee, Leila Moran. Good morning to you. The government is publishing a review, isn't it, and plans to reform the palliative care sector later this year. Your report seems to suggest you're not anticipating that will solve the problem.
Well, these problems are long-standing. I mean, this will be very familiar to many of your listeners. Frankly, we call it inadequate, and it's been inadequate for an incredibly long time. We've got services under significant pressure, postcode lottery of care at the time that you should have the best possible care at those moments at the end of life. So we are pleased, of course, that the government wants to give it some attention. They're drawing together what they're calling a modern service framework. And what we've said in the report is we are skeptical about that, simply because when we looked at what they meant by that, it does simply look like they are rehashing some of the standards that already exist that aren't being met without being clear about where the extra resources are going to come from.
And you think it needs extra resource, do you?
It certainly needs the attention, but we think it will also need resource. In particular, there are some areas we're concerned about. So children and young people's palliative care services need specific standards. And this is a Cinderella of the Cinderella service. I mean, these are tiny, tiny numbers, of course, Nick, right? 1% of the population a year dies, of which a smaller population of that might need palliative care. Only about half of them on the register, and children and young people are an even tinier proportion of that. The biggest issue here is that local commissioners often don't have the skills that they need to know what to commission. They don't know who they're doing it for, and there's also a workforce crisis like so much else. So we recognise that the government's trying to do something. The minister, when he came in front of us, Minister Kinnock, said that this modern service framework is going to act like a bat signal to the NHS. Well, that's all very well. But the other point we make is that there's no point in having that bat signal if you haven't also sorted out social care, which is a key partner in this as well.
Which we await a review of that, don't we? And that's some time off.
Well, indeed. And so you end up with, and this, there's a sort of general trend that we're noticing in the committee, which applies to this really important point of palliative care, but to others like dementia as well, to mental health services. They're pulling together these modern service frameworks and these intractable areas. And also there is a close linkage to social care. It does feel sometimes like these things are going to be pulling together things that already exist in order to push them into the long grass. So we want them to not do that. We are going to push them really hard to deliver in this parliament. These are big issues, but as everyone I'm sure can appreciate, in those last moments of life, especially for babies, children and young people, you should expect that you get a good service. And at the moment, we've got a postcode lottery where one nurse described it to the independent expert panel who helped us to put this together as she looks at the local authority that that dying person lives in. Sometimes she breathes a sigh of relief and sometimes she just sits in despair because she knows how different it can be across different local authority borders. And that's just simply not good enough.
Got to leave it there, I'm afraid. Thank you very much indeed. It's now 6 minutes to seven and we're turning now to the University Challenge specialist subject of my colleague here, which is whales.
One of my specialist subjects, a particular obsession, which is sperm whales. But thank you very much indeed, Nick. I try not to mention other programmes, but I'm glad you raised them because sperm whales, as we've been recounting this morning, Nick, are by any account among the most impressive creatures in our oceans. The largest of the toothed whales. They've got the largest brain of any living animal. Their heads are around a third of their body length. They emit the loudest sounds in nature through so-called clicks, which are louder than jet engines. And now, new research from the University of St Andrews has captured on film for the first time the fact that they headbutt each other. The findings have been published in the journal Marine Mammal Science this week, which I can't say I'm a subscriber to, but perhaps I ought to be. And Dr. Alec Burslem, who's a research fellow at the University of Hawaii and was the lead author of the research when he was at the University of St. Andrews, joins us now from Alaska. Dr. Burslem, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you very, very much indeed for joining us and congratulations on this research and these findings and this footage. To be clear, you weren't actually specifically looking for headbutting, but as is often the way with science, you made a chance discovery.
Yeah, that's well, first of all, thank you so much for having me on. That's exactly right. So this paper brings together footage from two different research groups working on completely different things. Me and Drs. Prieto and Silva were collecting body condition data. So that's looking at how fat the whale is as an indicator of its health and collecting blown samples in the Azores archipelago. And then my co-authors, Drs. Rendell, Brotons and Serda, were investigating the distribution and habitat preferences of sperm whales around the Balearic Islands.
And what did they find? What did they see? What did you capture?
Well, and in both cases, yeah, the observations were totally coincidental. So we just happened to have the drone in the air when the animals started performing this head-to-head and head-to-body contact behavior. So I remember very clearly, Rui, exclaiming that they're head ramming and looking over his shoulder and seeing this behavior. And it was really exciting because it's been sort of theorized for a long time, but not necessarily described scientifically with accompanying documentation like this.
And it must have been an amazing moment for all of you as people who've given your life to the study of these beasts and others in our oceans. Why do they do it?
Well, we're not sure. So obviously we've only got a few observations and sperm whales have these incredibly complex social lives, right? So a lot of things, important sort of contextual factors are probably changing at once. So we're not 100% sure of why this behavior was performed and what the absolute functional reason might be. We'd need more systematic data across lots of contexts to see what might trigger the behavior and what might change in the social context or as a result of it. But I think what these observations are showing us, with all of those caveats, is that sperm whales do, at least occasionally, appear to strike with force using the head. And also that those interactions using the head are more diverse than just headbutting and kind of span across this affiliative antagonistic spectrum. And they kind of raise questions rather than answering them, these observations. So We'd always theorized that this kind of headbutting combat might be between large males.
Dr. Burson, because we're going to have to go to a slightly boring compared to this weather, I'm afraid to say, but I think you were going to say that you found it in youngest whales, which was surprising. We look forward to seeing the footage, but huge, huge congratulations on this startling discovery. Dr. Alec Burslem from University of Hawaii.
Boring? It's never boring, Ben Rich. To tell him what's really going on.
Nothing competes with sperm whales. Come on.
Outrageous. Yes, well, anyway, the weather is not boring today. There's a lot of it going on. So if you are spending your day across the north of Wales or the north of England, you're going to have a band of cloud and outbreaks of rain. That rain turning increasingly heavy and persistent through the day. Some of that rain really piling up, actually, over the high ground in North Wales and the northwest of England. To the south of that, so for the south of Wales, for the Midlands, East Anglia, the south of England, a lot of cloud around, but it's going to be a mostly dry day. The cloud will thin and break at times to give some sunny spells, but the winds will really pick up here. Northern Ireland having a pretty cloudy day with some rain at times, particularly the further south you are. And then for Scotland, a very windy start, gales in the far north right now, some sunny spells, some showers from the word go, and then it will cloud over from the west with some heavier rain into the afternoon. Temperatures across the UK, 9 to 16 degrees, so far from boring.
Ben, that was riveting. Absolutely riveting. I'm so sorry, I'll never say that again. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Amal Rajan.
Good morning, it's 7 o'clock on Tuesday the 24th of March. The headlines this morning, the White House has said the situation in the Middle East is fluid after Iran denied President Trump's claim that talks were underway about ending the war. There have been further air attacks overnight with buildings damaged in Tel Aviv and deaths reported in Beirut. And the results of an inquiry into how much vets charge to treat household pets are about to be published.
Coming up in the next hour,
Vinny had a tumour under his armpit. We had a quote from the vets here in the UK for £1,600. We were in Italy and we took him to a vet's there, and it was £160 for everything.
A long-awaited report into vet pricing has been published in the last few seconds. We'll hear from the man charged with bringing down the cost of care in the UK, and Children's Laureate Frank Cottrell Boyce on the joy of Enid Blyton and her contemporaries, novelists who knew the delights of letting kids roam free.
Acres of newsprint have been filled with warnings that we don't allow our children adventures anymore, and that nowadays you're not even allowed to let your children live in the jungle without getting Baloo the bear and Bagheera the panther DBS checked.
The BBC News is read this morning by Vijay Ellis.
The US says its plans for holding negotiations with Iran remain fluid, despite President Trump saying major progress had been made towards a deal to end the conflict in the Middle East. Tehran denies any talks took place, but there are reports in the US that the Vice President, J.D. Vance, and Mr. Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, could travel to Pakistan to meet Iranian officials later this week. The White House says this is speculation and there has been no formal announcement. Our North America correspondent David Willis reports.
President Trump said that Iran had reached out to the US to negotiate after he had threatened to obliterate its energy infrastructure. Discussions, which began over the weekend, were set to continue this week, Mr. Trump added, involving a so-called top person within the Iranian regime. The comments were met with a mocking rebuttal from the Speaker of Iran's parliament, who called the suggestion fake news designed to manipulate the financial markets. But there are suggestions that messages indicating the United States is willing to negotiate have been relayed to the Iranian leadership through friendly countries such as Egypt and Pakistan. And the White House is not denying reports that a US negotiating team, possibly including the Vice President J.D. Vance, might meet with Iranian counterparts as early as this week in the Pakistani capital, Islamabad.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has vowed to continue attacking Iran and targets linked to Hezbollah in Lebanon. Officials in Beirut say two people have been killed in Israeli airstrikes on the city's southern suburbs. In the past half hour, it's been reported that an Iranian missile has hit central Tel Aviv, injuring at least six people. Our correspondent James Waterhouse reports from Jerusalem.
Despite the mixed messages which continue to emerge from the White House, Benjamin Netanyahu is ruthlessly pursuing his goals of striking Iran and its proxy Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. For the first time in days, Israeli air raids reportedly hit Beirut's southern suburbs, with the military claiming it targeted a figure from the Iranian Revolutionary Guard's foreign operations arm. It also says it captured two members of Hezbollah. Lebanese state media described at least five low-flying warplanes. As people's phones once again lit up with air alerts in much of central Israel, officials said a house in the north was damaged by cluster munitions from an Iranian ballistic missile. "We will protect our vital interests under any circumstances," warned the country's prime minister, who is not changing course.
The Saudi Defence Ministry says four drones have been shot down over an eastern area of the country with no casualties. A fire had to be extinguished in Bahrain, while Kuwait says some electricity supplies have been affected after debris hit power lines. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, is today expected to set out plans to prevent companies from unfairly raising prices because of the conflict in the Middle East. She will tell MPs that regulators could be given temporary powers to root out price gouging under a new anti-profiteering framework. Our political correspondent Jack Fenwick reports.
Rachel Reeves will tell MPs this afternoon how she hopes to prevent energy suppliers and petrol retailers ripping customers off. But ministers know they'll likely have bigger economic problems to grapple with if the war drags on. The energy price cap will shield many households from rising bills until the end of June, but Sir Keir Starmer is having to look at what support he may be able to offer after that. Given the tricky state of the public finances, he'd like that support to be targeted on those who need it most, rather than universal. But deciding who would and wouldn't benefit will be a politically difficult task, and one the Chancellor will likely be asked about later. She's also expected to talk about changing planning laws to make it easier to develop nuclear power plants, another move ministers hope will eventually cut bills.
Solar panels, which plug straight into the mains, will soon be available to buy in supermarkets as part of the government's efforts to speed up the transition to renewable energy. Our climate editor Justin Rowlatt has more details.
The government says it is working with retailers, including Lidl and Amazon, to make low-cost plug-in solar panels available within months. It's part of an effort that will see solar panels installed as standard on virtually all new homes. They'll get higher quality insulation and heat pumps too. But the Conservatives say the priority should be cutting the cost of all UK energy. They're calling on the government to scrap the windfall tax on North Sea energy profits and issue licences for new oil and gas fields.
The Metropolitan Police Commissioner says the force is investigating whether an Islamist group with links to Iran was behind the arson attack on a Jewish community group in North London. Sir Mark Rowley told an event hosted by the Community Security Trust, which monitors anti-Semitism, that all lines of inquiry were being pursued. He said 264 extra police officers would be deployed to protect the Jewish community in London. A long-awaited report on veterinary costs is being published about now. The investigation by the Competition and Markets Authority is expected to include legally binding recommendations for the sector. The watchdog has previously said it wants greater transparency around pricing and around who owns a vet's practice. Jim Connolly reports.
The CMA says the veterinary industry is worth £6.7 billion, and anyone who's had treatment for their pet in recent years will know how costly it can be. Average vet prices rose by 63% between 2016 and 2023. That's well above the rate of inflation. Critics say that prices shot up after six corporate chains bought more than two-thirds of practices. The companies deny this and say customer expectation has increased, as has the level of treatment available. Today's measures are designed to bring down bills, but the British Veterinary Association says keeping vet practices open is costly, and the CMA's decision can't alter that.
Air accident investigators in the US say they will interview the controller who was operating at LaGuardia Airport in New York when a plane collided with a fire truck on the runway. The pilot and co-pilot were killed. In a recording taken from air traffic control, the operative repeatedly asks the fire truck driver to stop. Jennifer Homendy from the National Transportation Safety Board says it will explore all possible causes of the incident.
We have a lot of data right now, a lot of information, including information on tower staffing. But the NTSB deals in facts. We don't speculate. We verify that information carefully before we provide it. So that is something we still have to do.
A number of postal workers have told the BBC they're being asked to move or hide mail so that it looks as if targets are being met. Royal Mail bosses are due to answer questions from MPs today, weeks after frustrated customers complained of delays. The company has acknowledged the problems raised by the BBC, but says the majority of first and second class post arrives on time. Coletta Smith reports.
Posties are under pressure to take out an increasing number of parcels every day. Since we first broadcast allegations about post being left behind, and after increasing pressure from MPs, we've been shown pictures of new signs in some delivery offices reminding staff that first-class mail must be delivered every day. But 10 posties from different delivery depots have now told me that they're regularly asked by their line managers to take the mail for a ride. That is, to take out bundles of mail on their rounds with them, but with no expectation of delivering them. Royal Mail has a legal obligation to deliver first-class posts 6 days a week. It told us it takes these claims very seriously, but they don't reflect how delivery operations work, and it carries out around 100 unannounced spot checks every week to make sure reporting is accurate.
Collector Smith reporting.
Vigi, thank you very much indeed. Well, as you heard from Vigi there, missiles are flying in all directions across the Middle East, despite President Trump saying that there have been productive talks. What about in Iran itself? Our international correspondent Joe Inwood has collated the latest material to make its way out of Iran.
There's a fighter jet above my head, he says. Air defences below. I'm not sure where exactly. But sometimes you don't need to understand a language to grasp its meaning.
Ooh.
The sound of fear is unmistakable. This is the unauthorized view of Tehran, filmed from rooftops in the dark. And for about 24 hours, there was a serious danger that darkness would be something the people of Iran would have to get used to. President Trump threatened punitive strikes against the country's power plants if the effective blockade of the Strait of Hormuz was not ended. It was the main subject people contacted the BBC's Persian service to discuss. And so, when that threat was lifted, the relief was clear.
Last night I was so scared about that power plant that I stayed up late, just listening to music and thinking about all the films I've always wanted to watch, and just everything I wanted to do, basically when 99% of them needed electricity.
But the lifting of the threat to power plants did not mean it was a peaceful day in Tehran. A group of men, wearing the uniform of the Red Crescent, carefully dig through rubble. We don't know exactly what else was nearby, but they say this was a residential building, and they're searching for a child. Whatever the truth of any one event, the destruction being done to Iran is unmistakable. On state TV, the anchor reads a message from the Speaker of Parliament. Our people demand the complete and humiliating punishment of the aggressors, it says. Donald Trump has claimed that negotiations are underway at Iran's request. They have denied that, and nothing coming out of Tehran suggests they are in the mood to compromise. It's a fact not lost on a man who once again got in contact with the BBC's Persian service.
I think this will be very costly for the Iranian people. Whether Islamic Republic remains or realizes that it's on its last legs, it will increase the cost to the Iranian people as much as possible.
Back at the site of the airstrike, and a woman in a colourful headscarf is helped by two Red Crescent workers. She stumbles, then falls into a man's arms. Behind them, a clean-up operation is already underway. Heavy machinery trying to bring order to a scene of chaos. But it is nothing compared to the diplomatic efforts ahead, after a month that has left peace in the Middle East a smoking ruin.
Well, that's Joe Inwood reporting, bringing us the latest on the material, or collating the material that's making its way out of Iran. Let's turn to Lise Doucette, our chief international correspondent. Lise, Morning. I mean, it's worth just saying, it's very hard listening to Joe Inwood's report. It's worth saying that the attacks that we've seen this morning suggest there is no obvious sign of de-escalation.
Good morning, Amal. The only de-escalation, if we can call it that, is that when President Trump came back from the dangerous, dangerous brink that he had brought Iran and indeed the world to, he de-escalated the situation in the sense that oil prices came down, at least temporarily, stock prices went up, and there was, and there's many accusations now, have to be proven, but of insider trading. President Trump came out with these declarations that you've now covered on this program, that there were very, very strong talks taking place. He spoke of a complete and total resolution of hostilities in the Middle East. It seems from what we can see, from what we hear, and a lot is still unclear, what is happening is far less serious and far less significant. Yes, messages are being passed from mediators such as Egypt, Turkey, Pakistan, countries which are not being directly attacked by Iran during this war. They all have very close ties to President Trump, but they're very, very preliminary talks, talks about de-escalation, talks about not attacking energy infrastructure. And all the while, as you've been reporting, those thousands of Marines are on their way to the region. There's talk even of ground operations and deep, deep, deep distrust still between the two sides.
And it's worth saying, I mean, just on those talks, which is this sort of the so-called off-ramp or the way out of this potentially through a diplomatic means, who is it that the Americans are talking to? And specifically, who is this important figure that's emerging, Mohammed Bakir Khalibaf, who Trump is said to be looking at as a potential partner?
President Trump has repeatedly said during this war that for him, Venezuela would be the perfect scenario for Iran. In other words, a repetition of what he did when American forces went into Venezuela, extracted the president, and then found someone who had their hands on the levers of power. It was the Vice President Delcy Rodriguez, who knew the system, who then became the president and was able to, up to a certain extent, bend to America's will. There is no Delcy Rodriguez in Iran. It is a completely different system. But they are casting about now, and they seem to have settled on Mohammed Bakir Khalibaf. And who is he? Well, the word we use is hardliner. They call themselves principalists, which means loyal to the principles of the Islamic Revolution. He is a person who knows the system. He's been part of it for decades. He was the Speaker of Parliament, a former member of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards, a former mayor. And the verdict on his tenure as mayor is very mixed. He did a lot of good to beautify this vast city of Tehran, make it more livable, but he's also accused of corruption. And importantly, during the wave of protests in January, he described the protesters as enemies and terrorists. But Amal, the idea that he would be about, to believe all of the speculation, go to Pakistan on this weekend and meet face to face with J.D. Vance is utterly fanciful. Even the foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, a veteran diplomat with a long experience of dealing with foreigners, only met for short periods during the largely indirect talks that he held with President Trump's favorite envoys, Steve Witkoff, the former property developer, and also Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law. That's just not going to happen. And we understand there may have been some telephone calls or some communications between Foreign Minister Araghchi and Steve Witkoff. But even for whatever you think of the Iranian government, President Trump's negotiating team is anything but idiosyncratic. I heard when I was in Tehran, I heard from diplomats who were close to the process, Europeans as well. Steve Witkoff goes to negotiations. He doesn't even take notes. And he goes to nuclear talks, which are highly, highly technical. And rarely, if ever, does he bring negotiators. So the Iranians were very pleased, nuclear experts. The Iranians were very pleased, and others as well, that Jared Kushner had joined the talks. But even that raised real, real questions during the last talks in Geneva. There were many comments afterwards that they wondered whether the American team really understood what was going on. And that is why the Omani foreign minister, Badr al-Busaidi, after the Geneva talks on February the the 26th, raced to Washington on February the 27th to meet J.D. Vance to try to explain to him what was at stake. February 28th, the war began.
Lise Doucette, our chief international correspondent, thank you very much.
It's now 7:18. The country's top policeman, the Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, Sir Mark Rowley, last night highlighted what he described as the rapid growth in recent years of Iranian state threats, which he called grave. He was speaking on the day of an attack on ambulances owned by a Jewish charity in Golders Green in London. Sir Mark said it was too early to link Iran to that attack, although counter-terrorism police are involved in the investigation. We're going to hear from them at 8:10. Now, for some years, Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee have been monitoring the threat posed here by Iran and our response to it. We're joined by the committee's chair, Lord Beamish, the former Labour MP, Kevin Jones. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
If Iran's involvement is confirmed, this would be part of a pattern that your committee knows all too well.
Well, in our report in 2025, we highlighted that the Iranian regime, whether it be the IRGC or Iranian security services, do attack dissidents, people who criticise the regime, and target the Jewish community. And they do that increasingly, not directly, but through proxies.
What, in other words, they hire people to carry out those attacks for them?
They do. And, you know, if you look at some of the attacks that have taken place over recent years, for example, between 2015 and 2019, there were four assassinations across Europe, both in Turkey and the Netherlands, that linked back to the main perpetrators being organised crime groups.
Does that make it harder for the police to detect?
It does, because what you're also dealing with here is not necessarily just organised crime groups, but also people who are just paid. So, for example, if you look, it's a type of approach which the Russians are using. So if you look, for example, at the attack last year on the warehouse in East London, many of those individuals who are not directly linked to any organised crime groups are just paid money.
Now, if, and it is an if, this is confirmed as a terrorist attack by Iran, they would have known what they were doing, wouldn't they? If you pour petrol or some other accelerant onto an ambulance and set fire to it, it's known there's oxygen inside, producing a huge explosion and potentially many deaths.
Well, yes, but in our report, it's quite clear the Iranians don't care about what you would call collateral damage if people were harmed. I would caution, though, with this attack, that the group that's claimed credit for it, Ashlabab al-Yami, is a new group. It only appeared in March. It's claimed responsibility for attacks on Jewish schools in Amsterdam and Rotterdam, for example. But also what you've also got to recognise, and we've covered this in our report in 2022 into extreme right-wing terrorism in this country, the Jewish community is increasingly under threat from homegrown UK-based right-wing groups as well.
Do you think that threat to the Jewish community is not being taken seriously enough? We heard voices on the programme yesterday saying if this had been an attack on a Muslim charity organised by Israel, the reaction would have been very different.
Well, no, I don't accept that. I think there's a lot being done to protect the Jewish community. But what I would say to people is follow what the commissioner is saying. I think it's too early to say whether this was Iran based. I mean, Iran is very clear, is that the security service of Iran, both the RGC and state security, you know, they're anti-Israel and anti-Jewish in their DNA. But the important point is that the attacks on Jewish communities here can also come from extreme right-wing terrorism, home-based. And like I say, we cover that extensively in our report on extreme right-wing terrorism in 2022.
But in a sense, are your observations reminding us that the war in the Middle East is happening here at home as well?
Well, it always does. And the, you know, whether it's Iranian involvement or whether it's extreme right-wing terrorists just want to create confusion and mistrust, which clearly it is, and fear in the Jewish community, or just ensure that, you know, communities are divided. The important thing, I think, is for communities to unite at this point.
Lord Beamish, Chair of Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee, thanks for joining us.
23 minutes past 7 into the business with Sean.
get the we've got the latest bellwether for the strength of our DIY desires. This is Kingfisher and its home improvement stores, B&Q and Screwfix. It's got stores across several countries, but it found it in the year to the end of January, so before this war in Iran began, the UK was one of its more resilient locations. Sales at B&Q and Screwfix up on the year. Charles Allen is retail analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence. Charles, morning. Why was the UK more resilient?
Well, I think that at the end of last year, we'd been seeing quite a lot of evidence that UK consumers who were nervous about the economy in general, but actually their personal financial situation was okay, were beginning to spend in DIY, and we saw it with Wix as well, for example. So I think it's not really a surprise that Kingfisher finished the year quite well.
So that reflects a little bit of what we've heard at the beginning of this year about some confidence in certain places. But yet, just in the last few minutes, another house builder, Bellway, has said prospects of interest rate hikes, demand downturn, rising costs will hit its business. So what will the coming months mean for B&Q and Screwfix?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that the next 8 to 10 weeks are really, really important for the DIY business. You've got Easter and the May bank holidays, and those are really when people decide whether they're going to do a lot of the sort of major projects in their gardens or homes. So is keeping confidence high in this period is pretty important for B&Q. And if there are any, well, there are signs. I mean, we've seen the petrol price up a lot. If there are more signs that sort of make people nervous, then it could subdue what is Kingfisher's peak period in the UK.
More widely, what's the impact of the advances of AI, people who are maybe plotting those Easter projects, feeling a little more confident to take that project management more on their own, and under their own volition rather than outsourcing it elsewhere? What would the impact of all that have on these industries, tradespeople and their role in that?
Well, Kingfisher has just announced an agreement with Google to bring agentic AI into its site so that you can better plan projects. I mean, it's something that DIY companies, and I'm sure some tradespeople, have been trying to do for ages and ages, is to actually get people to plan the project better so they can buy all the things they need. They don't botch it, so they're not dissatisfied at the end of it. So, getting agentic AI to plan projects, you know, laying a new terrace or something like that, is a sensible next step for Kingfisher.
Is it taking the role of those project managers somewhere down the line then?
Well, I mean, maybe, but I mean, I think that, you know, if you're getting into something large enough where you need a project manager or a building surveyor or something, it's, you know, you get involved with big building regulations and everything, and maybe some way down the road that will become something AI can do. But I think we're a little way off on that yet.
Charles Allen, thank you very much. Retail analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence.
Sean, thank you very much indeed. It is 26 minutes past seven and Carthy's here with the sport. Hi, Carthy.
Morning. Thank you very much. The England cricket captain, Ben Stokes, has posted an open letter to supporters on social media after the ECB review of England's 4-1 Ashes defeat to Australia announced that Stokes, head coach Brendan McCullum and the England team managing director Rob Key would all remain in their positions. In the passionate letter, Stokes says the past 3 months have been the hardest period of his England cricket captain. Some of his words are not repeatable at this time in the morning, but we can speak to BBC's cricket correspondent Stefan Schemmelt about it all. Morning, Stefan. You were at the CCB review. Did all three have to stay, or was it a case of if they sacked one of Stokes, McCullum and Key, then perhaps they would have to replace all three of them?
I think there's an element of that. I'm not sure they all had to stay together, but there's certainly strong links between the three of them. Rob Key appointed Brendan McCullum and Ben Stokes. It was Key who extended McCullum's contract through to next autumn. And that's when Stokes' central contract with England expires too. I think we can say there's a collective responsibility for the failures of the Ashes. So if one went, there would have been questions of the others. But now they're sticking together with the goal of getting through to the next series against Australia and winning back the urn in 2027.
You mentioned collective responsibility. I'm just interested in whether they have accepted that responsibility, because it wasn't just about poor performances on the field. There were issues off it as well. Was anything said about the drinking culture or just the social side of this tour, which caused problems?
All of the England management have accepted the mistakes on and off the field. They spoke about that in Australia and again yesterday, specifically in relation to the drinking. I think it's like any culture or team environment. It only becomes a problem if a team isn't winning, and England have not been winning. If you go back to the early days of the McCullum-Stokes regime, England won an amazing test match against New Zealand at Trent Bridge, and the players celebrated on the team balcony having a beer. They were filmed in a Nottingham takeaway that night. Ashes failures with England often come with accusations of a drinking culture. It happened in 2017-18. It happened 4 years ago as well. With the COVID tour, Rob Key has acknowledged it, but he's also said it's a wider problem in cricket and not just with this England team.
And in terms of on the field, what do we see next? What changes might we see ahead of England's next game, which I think is in the summer around June time against New Zealand?
Yeah, that first test match against New Zealand on June the 4th. I think a lot of the changes that supporters might have been expecting, this wasn't a ta-da moment at Lord's yesterday, a huge document landing on the desk and white smoke coming above the pavilion and a huge raft of changes coming in. There will be lots of things behind the scenes. So the things you mentioned, like culture, player behaviour, maybe the odd tweak of the backroom staff here and there. Maybe the most obvious thing would be the places up for grabs in the test team. I think Zach Crawley as opener, he needs a good start to the season. Jamie Smith, the wicketkeeper, he's under pressure. England need to find a frontline spinner from somewhere. And there's always a little bit of tinkering in the fast bowling department, depending on availability and injuries and all those sorts of things. So I don't think we're going to see any huge changes, but certainly after an Ashes defeat like England have just experienced, you can expect to see some changes in the playing personnel.
Okay, Stefan Chamont, thank you very much. And Stefan was part of the full test match special debate on the post Ashes review, and that is on the BBC iPlayer. It's also available as a podcast. Also, just to mention, Arsenal continue the defence of their Women's Champions League title tonight. They host Chelsea in the first leg of the quarterfinals, and there's commentary on 5 Live from 8 o'clock.
Thank you, Garthy. This afternoon, a long-running drama about the emergence of modern Britain draws to a close.
How is it possible that in a few days I will be 100 years old?
Faith, hope, and glory.
All we wanted, your father and I, was a better life for our children.
The century-spanning drama tracing the emergence of modern Britain.
They're telling me to get out, but I don't know anybody in Jamaica.
The final series of Faith, Hope, and Glory.
We belong here, and we are not going anywhere.
This Tuesday to Thursday afternoon at 2:15 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
A quick look at the weather today will be windy and cloudy with rain for many, though staying drier in the southeast.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Amal Rajan and Nick Robinson at, just coming up to 29 minutes to 8 o'clock. Here's Vijay with the news.
The US says its plans to hold negotiations with Iran about ending the war remain fluid. There are reports in American media that the Vice President, J.D. Vance, could meet Iranian officials in Pakistan later this week, though the White House says this is speculation. Iran has contradicted claims by President Trump that discussions to reach an end to the conflict were held yesterday. Iran has fired another round of missiles at Israel overnight. Authorities in Israel say 6 people were hurt in Tel Aviv, but not seriously. The Lebanese health ministry says 2 people have died in an Israeli strike on the south of Beirut. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says his country will continue its attacks on Iran and Hezbollah-related targets in Lebanon. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, is today expected to set out to MPs plans to prevent companies from unfairly raising prices because of the war in the Middle East. She'll outline plans to give regulators temporary powers to stop price gouging. The Metropolitan Police Commissioner says the force is investigating whether an Islamist group with links to Iran was behind the arson attack on ambulances belonging to a Jewish volunteer group in North London yesterday. Sir Mark Rowley says all lines of inquiry are being pursued. In a long-awaited report, the Competition and Markets Authority says vets will be legally bound to publish price lists and cap prescription costs as part of measures that will come into force later this year. The watchdog says a price comparison website will be created and veterinary practices will have to provide itemized bills and tell customers that cheaper prescriptions could be available online. MPs will question Royal Mail bosses today as the company comes under fire for delayed letter deliveries. A number of postal workers have told the BBC they're being asked to move or hide mail so that it looks as if targets are being met. Royal Mail says the majority of first and second class post arrives on time.
Fitchy, thank you. It is now 27 minutes to eight. Let's turn to that long-awaited report on the prices that people pay at the vets, published in the last half hour or so. The background is that of a two-thirds increase in prices in recent years, critics of the industry often blame the six corporate chains that now own more than two-thirds of vet practices. In a moment, we'll hear from the man who headed up the inquiry, what it might mean for you in the future. First, though, our correspondent Jim Connolly sets the scene.
Come on then, get a drink.
We may have come to meet Vinny in Kippax near Leeds, but he's a very well-travelled dog, right at home in owner Kelly's campervan, currently parked up here in West Yorkshire.
Good boy.
But they're often on the road in Europe.
So Vinny had a tumour under his armpit. We had a quote from the vets here in the UK for £1,600.
Quite a lot.
Very, yeah, quite expensive. So we were in Italy, as we travelled quite a bit, and we took him to a vet's there, and it was £160 for everything included.
Wow, that's a massive difference.
Ten times.
10 times, yeah. Was it any different, the treatment that you got, or...?
No, treatment was absolutely brilliant.
Do you think you'll always use a foreign vet now?
Obviously, if it was something like an emergency, we wouldn't have that option, yeah. So we'd have to find a vet here. However, anything for treatment-wise, yes, we would take him up to the EU.
We asked Kelly's UK vet for a response. They told us they did not wish to comment. She said the cost of insuring Vinny had risen so much as he'd got older that it wasn't an option either. Vet bills rose by more than 60% between 2016 and 2023, well above the rate of inflation. But the British Veterinary Association says it's too simplistic to blame the rise on more big businesses owning practices, saying treatment has advanced dramatically, as has customer expectation.
Hello, would you like to bring Lexi on through? Is that okay? Pop her up on the table.
Yeah.
And how have you all been getting on? Are you doing okay?
Hundreds of pet owners get in touch with us every time we do this subject via BBC Your Voice, like everyone in this report. But we also hear a lot from vets.
Will, thanks ever so much for having us down.
That's all right.
Will invited me along to the Vale Veterinary Practice here in Kidderminster.
You got in touch because you're frustrated with this idea that vets are making loads of cash, driving around in fancy cars.
Yeah.
Is that the reality of your life?
I'm afraid it's a little way from the truth. I'm driving a 10-year-old Seat, which is currently in the garage.
So there's no Ferrari pat around the back?
I'm afraid not.
Right,
okay. If you'd like to come on in, we'll show you how it really happens. I appreciate that it is very expensive. I appreciate that people are struggling. I do think that there are good reasons why the veterinary industry is so expensive. And there are also reasons why we're more expensive here than we are abroad. The cost of energy in the UK, which is extremely high for business. And also the veterinary wages in the UK are generally more in line with the cost of living.
Can you talk us through some of the costs that you face on a day-to-day basis just running the place?
When somebody has a bill for £100, £40 of that goes on staffing costs, £20 of that goes on drugs and consumables, £10 on the building, £10 on the equipment, 5 to 10 on other costs, and then the remaining 10 to 20, whatever's left, goes into profit. Most of that doesn't go into anybody's pocket, it just ends up being ploughed back into the business.
The frustration is clear from Will, and in the 2 years covering this story, it's a message I've heard from countless vets up and down the country. But back in West Yorkshire, Kelly is left with one big concern.
And we've often said this, you know, how do other people manage? There are people that are surrendering the dogs, maybe having them put down because they can't afford the cost here in the UK.
Today sees the announcement of changes to how vets operate. The pet owners I speak to just want one thing to come from it. Costs to go down so they can afford to own pets in the future.
That was Jim Connolly reporting, listening to that, the man who chaired the panel of the Competition and Markets Authority that's been looking into vets pricing, Martin Coleman, who joins us on the line from Westminster. Good morning to you, Mr. Coleman.
Good morning.
Reading the summary of your report, it seems that you've gone for that old phrase, sunlight is the best disinfectant. Transparency is what you think people who use vets should have.
Yeah. For much of the country, people have a good choice, in theory, of vets locally. For 90% of us, we have a choice of four or more vets in our locality. For 80%, we have a choice of five or more. The problem is that we don't have the information on which to exercise that choice. Many vets don't put prices on their website, even for basic things like vaccinations and consultation costs, when our pet unfortunately may need more serious, significant diagnostics or treatments, we are often not told about the potential cost, even though it could run into hundreds or even thousands of pounds. And we know, we found that medicine prices are often 50 or to 60% cheaper when bought elsewhere than at the vet practice, but many people don't know about that either.
And all so, that should be published, is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. What we are saying and what we're going to require by law is that vets put prices of basic services on a website, on their websites, that there is a price comparison service to enable pet owners to make those comparisons, that when the price of a treatment is likely to exceed £500, people will have to be told about that and given periodic updates, and that vets will have to tell pet owners that they may be able to get their medicines significantly cheaper online.
So in effect, it would be the same for getting that prescription as it would be at a doctor. You'd be handed a prescription and then you could choose where to take it.
Yeah, well, one of the things about prescriptions is that people have to pay a fee to get the prescription, which is perfectly fair because there is a cost involved in producing them. But those fees vary a lot. So what we are going to do is impose a cap on the price of prescriptions so people know the maximum they would have to pay, and there is and it makes it easier for them to go online if that's what they choose. Look, some people will choose, quite understandably, the convenience of buying from their vet. That's absolutely fine. The issue is they should have the choice and they should know what that choice involves.
Let me raise with you some of the objections that have been raised by vets, because these proposals are similar to the draft proposals that you produced a few months ago. The first objection they have is that you may be driving people to get their prescriptions online, where there could be another near monopoly supplier, that there could be other corporates just dominating the purchase of drugs online.
Well, there is a good choice of online pharmacies. And we know that the prices at online pharmacies are 50 to 60% lower than in vet practices. So competition seems to be working on the online pharmacy market.
The other thing they, or some of them, object to is these price comparisons, when they say it's very difficult beyond the very basic things, because different types of pets with different specific conditions for each individual pet, and therefore it's quite difficult to do these comparisons.
Yeah, well, look, the problem is that even all of the basic things are at the moment not there on the websites. And so things like the cost of a vaccination, neutering, basic dental treatment, basic scans, none of that at the moment is on a lot of websites, and there is no comparison site to deal with that. It is the case that when you get to more complex diagnostics and treatments, it is much harder to set that out in a standard way. There we've got another remedy we're going to impose. We're going to require the vets to tell the pet owners that the cost may exceed £500, or, you know, sometimes quite a lot in excess of that, and then to update pet owners regularly as that if that price goes up.
Can we take the advantage of the fact we've got you on and you're a veteran of competition law and of the Competition and Markets Authority, just to ask you about something that wasn't on your agenda today, but is very much on the country's agenda, which is how to avoid price gouging, as it's sometimes called, excess profits in the energy market. Now, you won't want to comment on the specifics, I know, but is there a role for your authority, the Competition and Markets Authority, in making sure that people get a better deal when they pay for their household energy bills?
Well, look, there is, of course, a specialist regulator for energy, but we are looking and have been looking at issues relating to household costs. We've been looking at the market for heating oil, for example, for road fuel, and we'll continue to keep an eye on those areas where it appears there's a problem.
So, and again, the solution might be a transparency, might it? People being much clearer about what they're getting and at what price.
Yeah, look, one thing that we learned looking at these areas is there's not one size fits all for everything. And what you have to do is look at each sector, look at what the potential problems are, the causes of those problems, and come up with the solutions that best suit that sector and the needs of the consumers in that area.
But the CMA, not well known by many people, but has a rather important role in affecting people's lives. Martin Coleman, chair of the CMA's Inquiry, Competition Markets Authority Inquiry into Vets Practices. Thank you for joining us.
18 Minutes to 8, a new film out this Friday, tells the story of a family who move from the city to the countryside, where the children discover a magical tree filled with strange characters and ever-changing worlds. It's a reimagining of Enid Blyton's The Magic Faraway Tree, first published in 1943. As is often the case in children's stories, the story really begins when the parents aren't there. We asked Children's Laureate Frank Cottrell Boyce to reflect on how authors have approached the challenge of the difficulty of children really having an adventure if the adults are always in charge.
Everyone knows that parents get in the way. The first step on the road to adventure is to arrange for Mummy and Daddy to be, at the very least, lost at sea, as in The Wolves of Willoughby Chase, or presumed dead in a plane crash, as in Enid Blyton's Secret Island, or burned to death when their mansion goes up in smoke. A series of unfortunate events. The person who does this with the most panache is, of course, Roald Dahl, who opens James and the Giant Peach with a moment that says, "You know we've got to do this, so let's do it quickly and not be picky about the zoology." James's parents are eaten by a rhinoceros. My own particular favourite comes in The Children Who Lived in a Barn by Eleanor Graham. Here, Mummy is invited to speak at an international conference somewhere foreign. Daddy says that Mummy will never be able to cope with travel. So let's leave the kids here on their own. They'll be fine. Unfortunately, he's forgotten to pay the rent, so the children are evicted and end up living on their wits in a barn. Then there are the parents who don't seem to mind what their children do. The boldest of these is, of course, Mr. Walker in Swallows and Amazons, who memorably, almost poetically, says, when asked if the kids can spend the summer in a dinghy on Coniston, "Better drown than duffers, if duffers won't drown." Sometimes the child can't shake the adult off. Just William's innocent desire to laze away his childhood is constantly thwarted by bothersome armies of aunts and older siblings and parents. These are stories that celebrate the resilience and resourcefulness of children. Acres of newsprint have been filled with warnings that we don't allow our children such adventures anymore, that the Walker children would all have to wear life jackets now, and that nowadays you're not even allowed to let your children live in the jungle without getting Baloo the Bear and Bagheera the Panther DBS checked. It's worth remembering that in the roots of all these stories, in the household tales of the Brothers Grimm, it was often the family that was the danger. A miller lies about his daughter's ability to spin straw into gold. A parent makes a foolish wish. The family in the juniper tree is a carousel of bloodshed and carnage in the home. In Enid Blyton's The Magic Faraway Tree, the children go into the enchanted forest in search of adventure. But often enough in traditional tales, children run away from the home and into the woods in search, not of adventure, but safety. There is another kind of story, stories in which the whole family goes on the adventure together, from the Swiss Family Robinson to the Finn Family Moomintroll. And of course, it takes a whole family and its cook to deal with the wayward Paddington. In Little Women and in the Moomin books, Mother, whether she's Marmy or Moomin Mama, is the real hero, carrying the solution to every crisis in her handbag. In fairy stories and in Enid Blyton, the child leaves home to find themselves. In Moominland, the family is the place where we learn tolerance and competence and bravery. Because, of course, the real adventure is family.
Well, of course. Our thanks to Children's Laureate Frank Cottrell Boyce for that wonderful reflection. The time now is 14 minutes to 8.
And it is time for Thought for the Day. The speaker with us in the studio this morning is the Reverend Lucy Winkett, Rector of St James's Piccadilly. Good morning, Lucy.
Good morning. In an interview on this programme yesterday, the former National Security Advisor Peter Ricketts was asked, "What about that old thing, wisdom?" It was in the contemporary context of the war between the US, Israel and Iran, a modern question that echoes the question in the Book of Proverbs, "Where can wisdom be found?" Good question. Difficult question. The search for wisdom today is in the context of the escalation of violence in the Middle East, and in the counting of over 60 active state-based conflicts and wars worldwide, the highest number since records began in 1946. And in the context of another escalation, the exponential growth in the capability and reach of artificial intelligence, which scientists are now calling the intelligence explosion, predicted in the 1960s, when human beings cede control of the growth and development of AI. In both of these enormous endeavours, the speed and scale of revolutionary action is disorientating for many populations around the world. And in both, the prosecution of global war and the seeding of the growth of AI to AI itself, the illusion of human control over events is inaccurate and has the potential to be ultimately destructive for, well, everyone. In short, it's easier to light the spark of AI than to control the spread of its flames, and it's easier to start a war than to end it. It is a question for our time. What is it in human beings that's served by our need for speed and escalation? As a species, we seem to give free rein to these instincts, sometimes useful, of course, but also with the capacity to brutalise and crush us. These instincts leave little room for creativity, kindness and selflessness that take more time than we seem to think we have. But the search for wisdom in scripture is characterised by the taking of time, by a commitment to restraint, self-discipline, and closely linked not so much to the acquisition of more knowledge, but to a desire to understand. Tomorrow, the first woman to be Archbishop of Canterbury will begin her public ministry with prayer, music, silence, and the gathering of community in a house of prayer that stood for 1,400 years. In gathering to sing and pray, it might look as if the church is fiddling while Rome is burning. But the ancient liturgy forms a different sort of public statement, that wisdom matters. And that even in the perilous times we're in, humility and grace point the way to another vision of what it is to be human before God.
That was Thought for the Day with the Reverend Lucy Winkett. Time now is 11 minutes to 8.
Later this afternoon, Rachel Reeves will tell the Commons how the government intends to help you with this energy price shock. At a select committee meeting yesterday, the Prime Minister said he was mindful of the huge strain on public finances already, and also uncertainty over how long the war will last. And he said that he and the government are minded to offer targeted rather than universal support. What might that look like? Well, Michael Shanks is the Energy Minister and joins us now. Mr. Shanks, good morning.
Good morning, Amal.
Thanks so much for joining us. What can you tell us now? We're mindful, obviously, that the Chancellor is speaking later today, but what can you tell us now, and to our listeners who are desperate to know what support there may be, about the new forms of support that you and the government might offer?
Look, we obviously absolutely understand that people across the country will be worried right now around what the impact of what's going on in the Middle East will be on the cost of living. So we've already taken action. On the 1st of April, regardless of everything that's going on, bills will fall because of decisions this government's taken, and that's the price cap that's in place until the end of June. But obviously we're now looking at what happens at the end of June, and that's partly what the Chancellor will say more about. We're obviously looking at a range of options, but we're 3 weeks into this conflict, although many of the signs are that the cost of living will have an impact. We want to be really clear about what that looks like. So we're monitoring prices really carefully, but prices will come down on the 1st of April. We've taken action already within 2 weeks to provide support for those off-grid households who use heating oil or LPG, for example. And of course, what we're also doing is learning the right lessons from this conflict so that we're not exposed to fossil fuels in the same way again, because this isn't the first time that households across the country have paid the price of our exposure to gas. We saw it in the wake of the invasion of Ukraine. And so the right lesson to take from this is, what support do we need to provide now for households? But equally, how do we protect us in the future so that we're not as exposed to fossil fuels?
Just on one particular point about the help that's coming, though, can you just confirm that the way you're looking at it at the moment, the help is going to be targeted rather than universal? That's a key distinction, of course, because if you look at what Liz Truss did compared to what Rishi Sunak did in a similar energy price shock, the Sunak interventions were targeted and as it were, kind of means tested. Is that the approach you'll be taking?
Look, genuinely, we've taken nothing off the table. So we're looking at all options. But clearly, the last action that was taken by the government cost £40 billion. So clearly, we want to look carefully at what any support might be, how it gets to people who need it the most. Okay. But we said, for example, on the heating oil point, that we leave it open to look at what households are in crisis in particular situations, not setting particular benchmarks around means testing. So look, we're open to this, and we're also looking really carefully at right across the piece how we can support families right now.
It's interesting you say that it's about learning the lessons and planning for the future. In France, the electricity price is usually set by nuclear power. In Germany, it's often coal. In other countries, it can be hydroelectric. In this country, gas generally determines wholesale prices. What can we do to reduce our dependency on other people's gas?
It's the absolute essential question that we should be answering from this. And that's why the government you're welcome. But that's why the government, long before this situation actually, embarked on the Clean Power Mission, because gas does set the price, even though we've got a huge number of renewables on the system. And so the answer is to build faster, more nuclear in this country as well. And part of what the Chancellor will say later will be about how we build nuclear much faster in this country. But it's also about how we build renewables and get them on the system and then build the grid that gets that clean power to homes and businesses, so that we're reducing bills.
That'll take a while, won't it? You know where this is going. Why not drill in the North Sea?
No, look, I don't accept the point. Look, obviously, for us to completely decarbonise the system will take time, but every wind turbine we switch on and every solar panel we switch on helps reduce our exposure to gas. And we've already seen gas setting the price a third less of the time than it did before. So the plan is working. We need to just keep building it. And in terms of the North Sea, look, for 60 years, it has been a hugely important asset powering the country. But for the past 20 years, it has been in decline. We've been a net importer since 2004. So although oil and gas from the North Sea remains hugely important in our energy mix and the workforce remains hugely important to us, our long-term future doesn't lie in fossil fuels. So we want to build up what comes next in the North Sea. It's an enormous opportunity for us in other technologies, and we're determined to make that happen.
And the other point the government often makes on this, excuse me, is that regardless of where it comes from, oil and gas is sold on international markets, which set the price for British bill payers, making us a price taker. I just want to quote to you, if I may, Greg Jackson. He's the boss of Octopus Energy. He's a business owner with a lot of skin in the game, right? He wants to keep bills down. He's got 10 million customers, largest energy supplier in the UK. This is what he said. When we're shipping liquefied natural gas, LNG, around the world, it is a lot dirtier than using locally produced gas. The UK needs more sovereign energy, and this requires practical, pragmatic decisions. We should use what's available from the North Sea. While the price is set globally, there's no point shipping gas from the other side of the world when we have it here. What do you know that he doesn't?
Well, firstly, we are doing that in the North Sea. Gas is coming ashore right now into homes and businesses across the country. So we're not closing that down, but we've been importing for more than 20 years. So the idea that this is just because Labour came to power in July 2024 is just nonsense. We've been a net importer because the North Sea has been in long-term decline. So North Sea gas will continue to play an important part, but it can't fill the gap entirely. It's necessary that we have a diverse range of supplies. That's been LNG for a long time. But it's also important we move even faster away from needing that fossil fuel in the first place. So, I mean, another thing we're announcing today around the Future Home Standard is how we build homes of the future that don't require gas in the first place, so that we are really clear we're making use of all the technologies that we know are available now, heat pumps and solar panels and everything else, to make sure we're protecting households in the future, getting us off fossil fuels. The North Sea will remain hugely important, but it isn't where our long-term future is.
But the key word there in the Greg Jackson quote was pragmatic. And I'm not denying for a minute what you say about the long-term decline of the North Sea. This is about whether or not, in response to a war and an energy price shock, which is hurting a huge number of your voters, you could make a pragmatic decision to turn up the dial on the North Sea. And it's not just business owners, it's also people who are involved in renewables. So Tara Singh, the chief executive of Renewable UK, said, and I quote, "I come to this debate with a simple view. Britain will be stronger, safer and less exposed if it produces more homegrown energy of every kind." So this is consistent with your position, isn't it, Mr. Shanks? It's consistent with your position that we should reduce our exposure to fossil fuels, to say that in the short term, you might make a pragmatic decision to turn the dial on the North Sea, creating jobs and tax revenue along the way, perhaps.
Yeah, look, pragmatism has been about how we've delivered this. So we had a manifesto commitment to not issue new licences to explore new fields, but to protect existing fields for their lifetime. And we decided last year that that would include so-called tiebacks. In other words, being able to drill for oil and gas adjacent to existing fields. That is a pragmatic way forward that manages existing fields. It was welcomed by industry and by trade unions alike as a way of managing the existing fields. But it also recognises that because we've had decline in the North Sea for 20 years, the long-term future isn't in that. So gas will continue to play a really important part. 100% of it comes ashore into the UK. We recognise how critical that is for jobs and for tax receipts and for the energy security it brings. But we can't get all of the requirements the country has from the North Sea.
Okay.
And it's worth just repeating this central point, which I think everyone you've mentioned so far agrees with, that none of it helps bring down bills. It won't take a penny off anyone's bills in this country. The exposure to fossil fuels generally is because we are a price taker. We're subject to the international market and we take whatever price that sets.
Tell you what else affects bills is tax. One price spike that's really hurting a lot of people is petrol. 55% of every pound we pay for in petrol goes to the government in tax. 38% fuel duty, 17% VAT. Why not be pragmatic and cut that tax now?
Well, that's why it's frozen until September, and the Chancellor and the Prime Minister have been clear that we're looking at that cost, and we will, but it's frozen until September, and that recognises that the cost of living is hugely important to the government, but we're looking at all of these things in the round. It's why we've provided support now. It's why we've frozen bills from the 1st of April. Bills will come down by 7% on the 1st of April. It's why we're taking the actions right now to protect us in the long term.
Which the Chancellor will expand on in the Commons today. Michael Shanks, thank you very much indeed for your time.
On BBC iPlayer.
What you see, you can't unsee.
Everything from nightmare fuel.
There's a beast on this island!
We've seen it!
We will have vengeance.
To nightmare remedies.
It's okay, I'm fine!
Don't laugh at me!
What's catch of the day? You are, Alan.
From chilling drama to laugh-out-loud comedy. Why ever you stream, BBC iPlayer.
Time for the weather now with Ben.
Thank you, Nick. Good morning to you. We've got a band of rain that'll be affecting some central parts of the UK today. So across the north of Wales and the north of England, expect thickening cloud and outbreaks of rain. Northeast England fairly bright at the moment, but that won't last by this afternoon. The rain will arrive here as well. To the south of that, for the south of Wales, for the Midlands, for eastern England and for southern England, actually a largely dry day in prospect. A fair bit of cloud around, but some spells of hazy sunshine. It will turn increasingly windy as the day wears on. For Northern Ireland, quite a mixed day. A few sunny spells around this morning, but already some rain down towards the south of Northern Ireland, and that will become more widespread through the day. And for Scotland, very windy in the far north right now. Sunny spells and showers initially. We will then see thicker cloud bringing some outbreaks of rain eastwards as we go through the day. And temperatures north to south across the UK around 9 to 16 degrees.
Thank you, Ben. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Amal Rajan and Nick Robinson.
It's 8 o'clock on Tuesday, the 24th of March. The headlines. The White House has described the situation in the Middle East as fluid after the US and Iran gave conflicting accounts of whether talks to end the war had taken place. In the next hour, we'll hear more about the man inside the Iranian regime supposedly negotiating with the White House.
I'm hearing from friends who've known Ghalibaf over the years that he's more a lick your finger and stick it in the wind and see which way the air is blowing person than necessarily still a staunch revolutionary.
There have been further air attacks overnight with buildings damaged in Tel Aviv and deaths reported in Beirut. New measures have been announced to cap some prices charged by vets and increase competition.
Coming up in the next hour, the UK's head of counter-terror policing and why he and his team are leading the response to the arson attack on four Jewish charity ambulances. Who will win the intriguing court battle between the Pentagon and the AI company Anthropic?
Fundamentally, Anthropic and the Pentagon don't actually have any disagreements about the current projects. This is a theoretical dispute about potential future engagements.
And
people were inspired by the chimpanzees, let's face it. It was a young girl out there with the chimpanzees. It was completely unique at the time.
That was the voice of Jane Goodall last night. The first Jane Goodall Awards were presented. We'll be joined by one of the winners, and she'll tell us about preserving the great primatologist's legacy. All that after the BBC News, read by Vijay Alice.
The US says its plans for holding negotiations with Iran remain fluid, despite President Trump saying major progress had been made towards a deal to end the conflict in the Middle East. Tehran denies any talks took place, but there are reports in the US that the Vice President J.D. Vance and Mr. Trump's special envoy Steve Witkoff could travel to Pakistan to meet Iranian officials later this week. The White House says this is speculation and there has been no formal announcement. Our North America correspondent David Willis reports.
President Trump said that Iran had reached out to the US to negotiate after he had threatened to obliterate its energy infrastructure. Discussions, which began over the weekend, were set to continue this week, Mr. Trump added, involving a so-called top person within the Iranian regime. The comments were met with a mocking rebuttal from the Speaker of Iran's parliament, who called the suggestion fake news designed to manipulate the financial markets. But there are suggestions that messages indicating the United States is willing to negotiate have been relayed to the Iranian leadership through friendly countries such as Egypt and Pakistan. And the White House is not denying reports that a US negotiating team, possibly including the Vice President J.D. Vance, might meet with Iranian counterparts as early as this week in the Pakistani capital, Islamabad.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has vowed to continue attacking Iran and targets linked to Hezbollah in Lebanon. Officials in Beirut say two people have been killed in Israeli airstrikes on the city's southern suburbs. At least one Iranian missile has hit central Tel Aviv, with reports of several injuries. Our correspondent James Waterhouse reports from Jerusalem.
There have been sirens and phone alerts in central and southern Israel as Iran continues to respond with salvos of ballistic missiles. The air defences keep most out, but not all, with at least one appearing to have struck central Tel Aviv. Emergency teams say they are trying to rescue people trapped in a shelter. Despite the mixed messages which continue to emerge from the White House, Benjamin Netanyahu is ruthlessly pursuing his goals of striking Iran and its proxy Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. For the first time in days, Israeli air raids reportedly hit Beirut's southern suburbs. Lebanese state media described at least five low-flying warplanes. "We will protect our vital interests under any circumstances," warned the country's prime minister, who is not changing course.
The Saudi Defense Ministry says four drones have been shot down over an eastern area of the country with no casualties. A fire had to be extinguished in Bahrain, while Kuwait says some electricity supplies have been affected after debris hit power lines. The Metropolitan Police Commissioner says the force is investigating whether an Islamist group with links to Iran was behind the arson attack on a Jewish community group in North London. Sir Mark Rowley told an event hosted by the Community Security Trust, which monitors anti-Semitism, that all lines of inquiry were being pursued. The Labour peer, Lord Beamish, chairs Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee. He told us the Jewish community was now facing a broad range of threats.
It's too early to say whether this was Iran based. I mean, the security service of Iran, both the RGC and state security, they're anti-Israel and anti-Jewish in their DNA. But the important point is that the attacks on Jewish communities here can also come from extreme right-wing terrorism, home-based.
A long-awaited report on vet pricing has been published and has set out ways to make the market more competitive, easier to navigate and more responsive to pet owners' needs. The Competition and Markets Authority investigation includes legally binding recommendations that vets will need to implement in the next 6 months. Jim Connolly reports.
The CMA says the veterinary industry is worth £6.7 billion, and anyone who's had treatment for their pet in recent years will know how costly it can be. Average vet prices rose by 63% between 2016 and 2023, well above the rate of inflation. Critics say that prices shot up after six corporate chains bought more than two-thirds of practices. The CMA says some are earning profits significantly higher than would be expected in a well-functioning competitive market. The companies deny this and say customer expectation has increased, as has the level of treatment available. The CMA inquiry chair, Martin Coleman, said the current situation was unclear for customers.
Many vets don't put prices on their website, even for basic things like vaccinations and consultation costs. When our pet unfortunately may need more serious, significant diagnostics or treatments, we are often not told about the potential cost, even though it could run into hundreds or even thousands of pounds.
Today's measures include price lists, a prescription fee cap, a price comparison website, and mandatory branding for large groups.
Ukraine's state emergency services says Russian attacks have hit residential buildings, a hotel, and factories in the eastern Poltava region. Two people were killed and 11 injured there, including a child. Three more civilians were reported dead in other attacks, with Ukraine saying it was targeted by 23 cruise missiles and more than 300 drones. The Crown Prosecution Service says it's concerned that some young people are unclear about what constitutes stalking. Its lead prosecutor on stalking has told the BBC that some victims recognised the behaviour they were experiencing was wrong, but did not realise it amounted to a criminal offence. More than 7,000 people were charged with stalking in England and Wales between 2024 and 2025. Here's our senior UK correspondent Seema Kotecha.
Stalking is a pattern of fixated, obsessive, unwanted and repeated behaviour that causes victims to feel distressed, threatened or fearful. But the CPS says some young people don't always understand when they're being stalked. It says sometimes patterns of behaviour can look like someone's being nice, such as sending lots of flowers. But if it's unwanted and repeated, it can quickly become criminal. The CPS is launching a stalking action plan, with one of the goals being to explore policy which could help educate young people about different forms of the crime. The government has commissioned an independent stalking review to examine whether current laws are strong enough.
Solar panels, which plug straight into the mains, will soon be available to buy in supermarkets as part of the government's efforts to speed up the transition to renewable energy. Our climate editor, Justin Rowlatt, has more details.
The government says it is working with retailers, including Lidl and Amazon, to make low-cost plug-in solar panels available within months. It's part of an effort that will see solar panels installed as standard on virtually all new homes. They'll get higher quality insulation and heat pumps too. But the Conservatives say the priority should be cutting the cost of all UK energy. They're calling on the government to scrap the windfall tax on North Sea energy profits and issue licences for new oil and gas fields.
The UN has named Atlantic salmon and the eel-like river lamprey, which are found in UK waters, among the 30 species of fish in most need of global conservation. It says freshwater migratory fish are facing a combined threat from dams, pollution and overfishing, which block their journeys to breeding grounds. Our climate and science reporter Esme Stallard has the details.
The Atlantic salmon and the Gunch catfish from Nepal are some of the 30 flagship fish species which have been prioritised for global conservation by the UN. Population data of more than 15,000 species of freshwater migratory fish, which make up half of all fish species, were assessed by a team of international scientists to identify those most at risk and culturally significant. The fish they selected will now be put forward for listing under the International Convention on the Conservation of Migratory Species. It sees countries coordinate protection efforts crucial for animals that migrate across borders. In recent years, animals that have been listed, like the Saigon antelope, have recovered from near extinction.
A number of postal workers have told the BBC they're being asked to move or hide mail, so it looks as if targets are being met. Royal Mail bosses are due to answer questions from MPs today, weeks after frustrated customers complained of delays. The company has acknowledged the problems raised by the BBC, but says the majority of first and second class post arrives on time.
Vijay, thank you. It is now 8:10. We speak of the war with Iran as if it is happening thousands of miles away in the Middle East. But is it in fact also happening here at home? Last night, the Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, Sir Mark Rowley, highlighted what he described as the rapid growth in recent years of Iranian state threats. He called them grave. He was speaking on the day when three men in hoods had set fire to ambulances, which exploded as they were carrying oxygen cylinders. They were owned by a Jewish charity in Golders Green in London, an area with a large Jewish population. So Mark was speaking last night at the annual dinner of the Community Security Trust, which monitors anti-Semitism in the country and aids and advises Jewish organisations, schools and synagogues on security. He said it was too early to link the attack to Iran, but emphasised that counter-terror officers were investigating. And we're joined by the man who heads counter-terror policing in the country, Assistant Commissioner of the Met, Lawrence Taylor. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Not yet linked to Iran. Too early, says Sir Mark. What is it that your officers are looking for?
Thank you. Well,
Clearly, these incidents have a huge impact on Jewish communities. The Jewish community are, you know, they're hugely strong. They're very resilient. But with a series of events that we've seen both in the UK and across the globe, they are rightly very nervous. So when we have incidents like this, where there are possible links to foreign states, there are potential concerns around the casework that we see, it's right and proper that counterterrorism policing, using the capabilities, the skills and the experience that we bring to these investigations, take the lead. And clearly, as Sir Mark said last night, that link to a possible state-backed incident is one line of inquiry. Clearly, it's too early to say at this stage.
Is the link with the state the thing that is needed to call it a terror attack? Because at the moment, the police have called it an anti-Semitic hate crime.
Yeah, so part of our investigation is trying to identify the motivation behind the individuals who have conducted this attack. Clearly, our priority is getting them into custody and bringing them to justice. To answer your question specifically, for it to be a terror incident, no, it doesn't necessarily have to be state-backed, but that might be one of the factors we need to consider when determining whether this is a terrorist incident or not.
But it would have to be carried out with the purpose of creating terrorism, with intimidating and spreading fear.
That's right. Intimidating a section of the public and its intention to do so. But then it also links to the ideology and the motivation of those individuals involved. And that's exactly what our officers are now investigating and trying to understand why this attack took place.
And presumably investigating this claim, and it is only a claim, from a new group. HAYI translates as Islamic Movement of People of the Right Hand. What do you know about that group, and how seriously are you taking this new website that's been created, claiming a whole series of anti-Semitic attacks?
Well, clearly it's very worrying both for the community, but also for us. We need to understand more about that group. You'll be aware that they have claimed a number of incidents across Europe. As I said earlier, that is one line of inquiry that we're undertaking. We work incredibly closely with our security service partners, and collectively we are exploring who that group are, what their motivations are, and what level of involvement they had, if at all, in the Golders Green incident yesterday.
Now, if there's a link, and I do stress the word if, a link with Iran, it certainly won't be the first case of this sort, will it? And we were hearing earlier in the programme from Lord Beamish, who chairs Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee, that there's an increasing pattern of Iran paying either petty criminals or organised criminals to carry out attacks for them.
Well, certainly we've commented on this. The Director General of MI5 commented towards the end of last year, identified more than 20 Iranian-backed plots in the UK since October 2024, and they include everything from assassination to kidnap to espionage, and of course potentially creating fear within those Jewish communities. And more broadly, this is an area of our work that we are seeing a very significant increase. In the 6 months to December last year, we saw a 50% increase in our National Security Act investigations compared to the previous 6 months. So it's a threat that we're acutely attuned to. We're very aware that it requires some different investigative skills and creates some different challenges for us. But it is one that we are very keen to attack and target.
Will it require a different security response as well to protect the Jewish community? There is one rabbi quoted in the newspapers this morning of saying that synagogues will now have to be protected like targets in South Africa, with high security fences, not as now, which is bad enough, with people with walkie-talkies and stab-proof vests.
We've already got a very heightened security posture working with the Jewish community. We are very fortunate to have a fantastic relationship with Community Security Trust and other partners within that community. We're providing advice. We're using the skills and capabilities that we have available, going beyond traditional neighbourhood policing, where clearly we have an enhanced posture for visibility in those locations across the country. But we are also looking at our protective security posture, what expertise we can bring, using everything from drones to live facial recognition to our servitor teams who are behavioral analysis, who can then look at people in the area, as well as providing advice and training around hostile reconnaissance and other things. So it's a threat we are very aware of. We completely understand the concerns within Jewish communities and the fear that this creates. And we're absolutely determined to bring those individuals to justice and the impact this has across the country.
Can we just finally pause and consider what those words security posture mean? It means that Jews in Britain who are offering healthcare to people in their own community and beyond it, who are going to pray in synagogue, who are going to school, have to be protected as if they're going into a prison. It is an extraordinary state of affairs in our country, isn't it?
It's absolutely extraordinary, and something that I absolutely wish we didn't even need to be having a conversation about. It's appalling that members of British communities are targeted in this way, and that's why it's so important that counterterrorism policing bring those individuals to justice. We understand the motivation behind those attacks, and we continue to work closely with the community to keep them safe. It is very sad. You'll have seen just at the end of last year the incident in Manchester, Operation Catagenic, where we brought two people to justice, where they were planning an attack that would have been absolutely horrendous. We are good at this. We've stopped 19 late-stage terror attacks in the last 5 years, but that doesn't stop the fear, and it's really important we continue to work. I think it's very sad that we have to have this conversation. Sadly, at the moment, we do.
The war with Iran is happening on our own turf.
It's clear that the impacts from the war, and actually we've seen it since the attacks in October 2024, we have seen an uptick in our caseload. It clearly has an impact. We monitor incredibly closely what that domestic impact could be. But global conflict across the world will always have an impact, not just in the Middle East, but we've also seen it from Ukraine and other areas. It can tip people into taking action that we wouldn't want them to do, and it's something we have to monitor incredibly closely.
Assistant Commissioner Lawrence Taylor, Head of Counterterrorism Policing at the Metropolitan Police, thank you very much for joining us.
19 minutes past eight. Well, let's turn to the Middle East more directly and get Jeremy Bowen's assessment of what's going on there. Jeremy, good morning. It's interesting. Is there a bit of a divide opening up, Jeremy, here between America and Israel, in the sense that for Israel, it's existential. For America, it's a war of choice. And you've got, on the one hand, Trump saying there've been very good discussions on ending the war. But meanwhile, Netanyahu in the last few hours has said and vowed that Israel will continue to strike in both Iran and Lebanon.
Yeah, Amal, you know, when all this started, just after the first attacks of February the 28th, Prime Minister Netanyahu did a piece to camera, which he put on social media, I think filmed on the roof of the Defense Ministry in Tel Aviv. And he said, I have been wanting to do this for 40 years. Mm. This has been my project because Iran is such a threat to Israel. That is a deep belief of his going back a long way. I remember him talking about a previous Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, about 15 years ago. And he came to our office at the BBC in Jerusalem and he said, it's 1938 and Ahmadinejad is Hitler. Now, that was clearly an exaggeration, but it shows his mindset. And in Donald Trump, he found a partner in previous U.S. presidents during his time, and he goes back to Clinton in the 90s, were not prepared to do this with him, but Trump was. But America is a global power with all sorts of interests, and it's much more complicated for the U.S. Plus, there's a man in the White House who doesn't appear to have thought through the consequences of what he was doing. But for Netanyahu, for him, it is much simpler because he says it's about existence. He's also got to be re-elected this year. He's hoping to be re-elected this year. Interestingly, his own poll numbers haven't really moved, though the war itself in Israel is very popular.
Trump is often influenced, in fact, generally influenced by what's happening in various markets, whether it's commodities or equities and potential implications of that on interest rates and inflation for his voters. It's not what are the options for Trump right now? Does he have any good options? Does he have what's the least damaging off-ramp for him?
Probably finding a way to get out of this from his perspective, because he too faces midterm elections, or rather, you know, the Republican side of US politics does, in November. And, you know, if he could get out of it now, by then, perhaps the whole business about expensive petrol prices and so on, we're entering what in America they call the driving season fairly soon. So all that will be quite significant. However, there are also options about escalation. And if I've got huge question marks in my mind about this suggestion that they're having real talks with the Iranians, because the agenda is so complex, you know, from that enriched uranium to the Straits of Hormuz. And I think the Iranians now are thinking, well, maybe we could do a deal. And if he has got to the point where he's taken too much pain, then they can extract a price. And the kind of demands they would have might be some continuing de facto ability to influence shipping in the Strait, apart from their own geographical position. What about lifting sanctions? What about extracting a promise from the US that Israel would stop bombing them at will after a ceasefire? Would any of this be practical? I mean, it seems to me to be an extraordinary complex thicket. So maybe what Trump is preparing to do is, as people thought he might do from the outset, which is get to a certain point and think, right, this is what we've done. This is what we've achieved. We've done massive damage. And now we are going to declare victory and go home. But that will leave a big mess behind in the region.
Is one consequence of this war, Jeremy, perhaps unforeseen by some people in Washington, that it sort of created the revelation in Iran, the discovery that their real leverage is not the potential that they could have a nuclear weapon, but the potential, but their control of the Strait of Hormuz? There's a sudden sort of complete awakening in Tehran to something they might have been aware of before, which is that by really tightening and strangling the Strait of Hormuz, they can cause huge economic damage across the world.
Yeah, the during the so-called tanker wars, during the Iran-Iraq war, back in the late 80s, there was also pressure on the Strait of Hormuz back then. But since then, the whole structure of world trade has changed. Supply chains are way more interdependent than they ever were. Parts for even an individual product or fertilizers, we've been hearing earlier on in the program, all sorts of things are shipped around the world in a way that back in the 80s they absolutely weren't. So while I think they undoubtedly were aware of the fact that this is a great choke point in the world, I don't know if they realize it had become such a sort of choke point on steroids, if you like, because of the way that international trade has changed and that we are all so dependent on this stuff.
Jeremy Bowen, our international editor, thank you.
We're going to be hearing from somebody who worked in the first Trump administration, reflecting on what it was that the president has been thinking and is now thinking a little after half past eight. Before that, Cathy's here with the sports news.
Morning. Thank you very much. Ben Stokes says the past 3 months have been the hardest period of his England cricket captaincy. He's posted an open letter to fans on social media after the ECB review of the Ashes announced that Stokes, head coach Brendan McCullum and managing director Rob Key would all remain in their posts despite a 4-1 Ashes defeat over the winter. The ECB said it needs a 4 years Ashes planning cycle and has identified the protection of a 4 to 6 week window before an Ashes tour. Concerns were raised about the team's preparations before this Ashes test, but Rob Key has defended the decisions made.
You know, at the time, I think we'd won every series that we played with that sort of preparation, whether it was going to Abu Dhabi, whether it was practicing amongst ourselves, and we had 100% record, I think, of winning the first test away. And the other point was that we were falling off a cliff at the end of series. So we were trying to find that balance. Now, would we have won the series had we gone and played a game in Adelaide against an Australian side? Maybe. But would we have stopped the noise? Yes, definitely.
Football and Arsenal continue the defence of their Women's Champions League title tonight when they host Chelsea in the first leg of the quarter-finals. I've been speaking to the former Chelsea, Arsenal and Lioness goalkeeper Siobhan Chamberlain about how the dynamic of the domestic rivalry might change in Europe.
It's a really exciting game tonight and I cannot wait to watch it. But I am slightly frustrated at the fact that both teams can't get through to the semi-final. I suppose you could spin it and say at least there's going to be one team in the semi, but it's such a huge game. Obviously, Arsenal, reigning champions, Chelsea have never managed to win that Champions League trophy. So there's so much on the line and it should be a really, really exciting game by two teams that know each other really well.
That is the interesting part of it, isn't it, that they know each other so well. But Arsenal are, as you mentioned, reigning champions in Europe, the only English side to win this prestigious title. How could that change the Arsenal mentality going into this game?
I think it might give them more confidence that they've got the belief. They know that they had that fantastic win in the final. They know they've got the history. But I think as you're a player in that dressing room, history goes out the window. It doesn't matter what's happened before. What happens is, what's important is what comes next. And there's, both teams have got a lot of injuries. They've got players out that are returning from the Asian Cup. So unfortunately, it won't be both teams' strongest sides that we'll see out there. But it'll be interesting to see how the squad depth adapts, which team can adapt the best to it.
We are in that part of the season where you say that we have injuries for both sides. Chelsea, though, have had so much domestic success over the last decade. They come into the fixture having already won the Women's League Cup this season. It is getting a bit repetitive, though, to ask, how do they convert that domestic success to European success?
Well, they're definitely getting closer. They're getting to more semi-finals, they're getting to more quarter-finals. They just haven't got that one over the line yet. And I think that's testament to how competitive the game is. And the fact that it looks like Chelsea aren't going to win the WSL this season, for me, it's brilliant for the league because it's so much more competitive. They're fighting at the moment to even get a Champions League place for next season. So the fact that there's more teams competing in it makes it more difficult, but also should set Chelsea up to be better prepared and in a better position to then fight for that Champions League trophy when that time comes.
You set it up very nicely, Siobhan Chamberlain. Thank you very much for talking to us this morning.
Thank you.
And there's commentary of that Champions League quarter-final on 5 Live from 8 o'clock tonight.
Cathy, thank you very much indeed. Now here's Jim Al-Khalili with details of the Life Scientific coming up at 9 o'clock.
Hello. Today we're heading to the tropical island of São Vicente in the Atlantic, where trade winds arrive cleansed after days travelling over open ocean. It's the kind of pristine air that atmospheric chemists dream of. Chemists like Professor Lucy Carpenter. Lucy helped found the Cape Verde Atmospheric Observatory and subsequently uncovered a startling fact that the oceans themselves contribute to ozone loss. I'll be talking to Lucy about this discovery as well as her work shaping global climate policy as co-chair of the Montreal Protocol's scientific panel. Join us for the Life Scientific after the news at 9 or on BBC Sounds.
Jim, thank you very much indeed. Quick look at the weather today. Will be windy and cloudy with rain for many, though staying drier in the southeast.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Amol Rajan. It is 29 minutes past 8. Here's a summary of the news from Vijay Ellis.
The US says its plans for negotiations with Iran remain fluid after Iran denied Donald Trump's claim that talks had taken place. American media is reporting that the Vice President J.D. Vance could meet officials from Tehran for talks later this week. The White House says those reports are speculation. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says his forces will keep attacking Iran and targets linked to Hezbollah in Lebanon. Officials in Beirut say two people have been killed in Israeli airstrikes. The Metropolitan Police Commissioner Sir Mark Rowley says the force is investigating whether an Islamist group with links to Iran was behind the arson attack on a Jewish community group in North London. The head of counter-terrorism policing at the Met, Lawrence Taylor, told us his officers were very attuned to potential terror threats against Jewish sites and that there had been a very significant increase in cases brought under national security legislation. Vets will have to cap prescription fees at £21 and publish price lists among new measures coming into force later this year. The competition watchdog carried out an in-depth investigation and found that prices had been rising at nearly twice the rate of inflation.
Vijay, thank you very much indeed. Well, later today, Rachel Reeves will be setting out some plans in the Commons to help people, particularly with the spike in energy prices. We think that's going to be much more targeted than universal support. And Chris Mason, our political editor, is on the line now, can hopefully give us a little bit of a briefing. Chris, morning.
Morning.
You've got this really interesting post, actually. I was reading it overnight on the BBC News website, which kind of takes us inside the government's thinking on the cost of living crisis. Because this was meant to be the year of the great turnaround of things getting better, people feeling better. But alas, events, dear boy, events.
Yeah, exactly that. I was just looking back this morning at some of the words from the Prime Minister in the opening weeks of this year, and he was tentatively talking in public about Labour turning the corner, as he put it, talking about inflation being down, wages being up. And ministers at the time, Amol, were privately expressing frustration that events were crowding this off the airwaves. Venezuela, Greenland, Lord Mandelson, Andrew Mountbatten, Windsor. But now an event, this war, with the potential not just to crowd it off the airwaves, but to snuff it out entirely. And yeah, that's the context in which Rachel Reeves will address MPs later.
The government, it was interesting talking to Michael Shanks, the energy minister, just before 8 o'clock on this whole thing about North Sea drilling. There is a dividing line, isn't there, now, where there's a clear position that Labour have got, and Ed Miliband has staked out that there will be no more licences issued for North Sea oil. And they're kind of, there doesn't seem to be much flexibility on that. They are doubling down on the idea that actually renewables are the way forward.
Yeah, Ed Miliband was addressing Labour MPs at the weekly meeting of the Parliamentary Labour Party last night, was doubling down on exactly that argument. People I speak to in government talk about how vital they think it is to go gangbusters on renewables and nuclear, as one senior figure put it to me. They say, both sides of the argument double down on their position as this being a case study and why their view was right in the first place, to be honest. So those on the sort of Ed Miliband side of the argument say the roller coasters, they put it, of fossil fuel prices justifies the dash towards renewable because it's more predictable, they argue, in terms of price. The argument you hear from others, and you were challenging Mr. Shanks about it half an hour or so ago, is hang on a minute, what about this resource very close to us? And even if it is tapped and then on an international market, what about the environmental benefit of using a fuel that doesn't have to be taken all the way around the world? And we're seeing the Conservatives and Reform doubling down on that argument as far as the North Sea is concerned. One or two Labour MPs entertaining the idea privately as well. I think for as long as this remains a live topic, that question around the North Sea will remain live too, because there's just no doubt people will point to it when there's an argument that's made that everything should be done.
Chris, good to talk to you. Thank you.
At 27 minutes to nine, let's turn to the cause of that extra pressure on the cost of living, the war in the Middle East, the war between Iran and the United States. Have there been productive conversations between the two countries? Yes, says Donald Trump. No, says the man he claimed his advisers had spoken to, the Speaker of Iran's Parliament. It seems that what there has been is talks about talks involving mediators from other countries. The question then is whether this is the start of a diplomatic process for ending the war, or merely a means to reassure the financial markets that Donald Trump wasn't about to launch a deadly and economically destructive new phase of that war, or indeed to buy time, as some of his supporters hope, for the arrival of US Marines in the region. I've been speaking to Kirsten Fontenrose, former senior director for the Gulf at the US National Security Council in the first Trump administration. She now is at the Atlantic Council. She told us what we know about Mohammed Ghalibaf, the man the Trump administration are reportedly eyeing as a potential negotiation partner.
He's considered a hardliner. He has strong ties with the IRGC. He's seen as kind of the link between the IRGC, the bureaucracy, and the new supreme leader, assuming the supreme leader is alive. But he's believed to be more interested in self-promotion than ideology. So the U.S. is exploring whether he could be the Delcy Rodriguez of Iran.
There is a fascination in the White House, isn't there, with this so-called Venezuela option, the kind of acceptable hardliner who's ready to do a deal.
And that's because it's believed that a deal is in the country's interest and that someone who's interested in self-preservation would be willing to take this right off the ideology and say, I'd rather survive, I'd rather lead a future government, I'd rather be somewhat of a hero in the history of the country than necessarily live the rest of my life in a bunker or like some of the leaders in Iran are doing right now, sleeping in their car and moving around to avoid strikes or sleeping in tents in the forest.
The demands that we're told that are being made, an end to the nuclear program, effectively an end to the ballistic missile program, and no proxies, in other words, no support for the likes of Hezbollah and Hamas, would be seen by anybody in the Islamic regime as surrender, wouldn't it?
Remember, along with those demands are coming offers. So part of that kind of deal would also include an end to some sanctions, waivers on the sanctions that couldn't immediately be lifted because of thresholds on them or congressional approval or the like. Also, promises of foreign direct investment that would come in, discussions about potential enrichment coalitions for the region of uranium. There are things that are being offered that could potentially make that person look like they had rescued Iran's economy and brought the country into a new era. So it's not simply punishment. That's part of the reason the Trump team has been so surprised that Iran so far has not agreed to accept this deal, because it wasn't only a hammer. They really did come in with offers as well. It's just that you have the sanctions economy has allowed for the IRGC and some of these leaders to really claim monopolies in certain economic sectors. They've made a lot of money. So one, you have the ideologues. Two, you have the folks who've gotten rich. But there are some things that could really benefit the country, maybe benefit them financially, and perhaps make them look like, you know, they're bringing Iran out of a negative era and into the light.
Doesn't all this suggest that this military assault on Iran was based on a whole series of miscalculations? The assumption that Iran might behave anything like Venezuela, when it is much more ideological. The assumption that because America didn't need Iran's oil, that global markets would not go tonto when the Straits of Hormuz were closed. And the reality that the Gulf states, America's traditional allies, would be willing to tolerate the attacks on their economies and on their way of life. All these were miscalculations, weren't they?
I would argue the opposite. I think the military pressure was necessary to potentially move the regime away from their long-term, I mean, four administrations worth of the same stance. We will develop a weapon. We will develop missiles. We will have it all our way. It also might have eliminated some of the truly ideological leaders to get down to someone who might be more interested in self-promotion, self-preservation, maybe a new future for the country. I'm hearing from friends who've known Ghalibaf over the years that he's more a lick your finger and stick it in the wind and see which way the air is blowing person than necessarily still a staunch revolutionary. That could be wrong, but it's a gamble that the U.S. is taking. Remember that the U.S. has been impacted less harshly than the rest of the world has, frankly, by things like the closure of Hormuz. So it was a national security priority over the economic potential impacts, and it's worked out so far for the U.S. And frankly, the military pressure that then caused Iran to overreact and hit their Gulf neighbors in their sectors that are more civilian has caused the Gulf to change, and now they are allowing the U.S. to do overflights. They have said, we will not tolerate this regime anymore. So it's actually moved the Gulf position. So in fact, I think some of this military action, military pressure, has worked out quite well for the U.S. objectives.
Many people look at what Donald Trump has said and the contradictions, apparent contradictions, over the course of a few hours, that he made a threat which he wasn't prepared to carry out, which panicked global markets, produced a soaring oil price and the price of debt as well, and he simply needed a way to back down.
No, I don't see. Remember his background as a negotiator. And what that means is you create a crunch timeline. You put down an ultimatum and say, this offer is only good for the next 36 hours. And that was what that threat was. Then by exploring whether or not there were people within the regime remnants who were willing to potentially come off of that hardline stance because of that threat, then you start to see who you can work with. The administration's view is that the U.S. action has been like a forcing function to deal with a problem that's been simmering and required continual attention and resourcing and management for 40 years. And the regime, unless it was put under that kind of pressure, was willing to keep that conflict on simmer for perpetuity, just pursuing that goal it had been articulating for decades about bringing death to America and death to Israel. And the administration has been talking to itself and saying, look, we've been spending U.S. taxpayer money on avoiding these conflicts or keeping them at the simmer for way too long. And that would have included Venezuela. I think it also now includes Cuba, when we should once and for all eliminate the threat, eliminate the ongoing cost and the stressors that unaddressed and bled the budget, distracted and derailed our foreign policy objectives, and now have said we're going to put an end to this. We're going to apply those funds that we will save toward other American problems going forward if we can deal with this right now, once and for all.
Kirsten Fontenrose of the Atlantic Council, thank you very much for joining us.
At 19 minutes to nine, some good news. England has recovered from drought. It comes after 4 months of above average rainfall, which caused flooding in some parts of the country. But England has now recovered. East Anglia has become the final area to move out of the recovery phase from drought, with all regions in England now classed as normal. The Environment Agency said the risk of drought in 2026 was currently low. Lucy Munns is a farmer in Cambridgeshire whose reservoir of water saved her crops during the drought. We asked her if the end of the drought heralded a bumper crop for her.
In terms of looking forward to a better crop, yeah, you don't know what it's going to do in the summer, to be honest. The weather can't actually predict properly what it's going to do in the next 2 weeks. So we'll look forward to what we get. But it just goes to show the importance of storing water. In my opinion, I think it's a really, really good idea because we do need to be able to store this water over winter with the amount of rain that we're getting to then go and reapply it in the summer. We need to be more self-sufficient, really, as a country.
Well, let's pick up on those ideas with Paul Tompkins. He's the Deputy President of the NFU and a farmer in Yorkshire. Paul, good morning.
Morning, Amal.
Thanks so much for joining us. Does this news about the end of drought come as a relief?
Well, it's good news, but for the National Farmers Union, this isn't about today's drought status.
Of course.
I guess it's about preparing for what happens, as Lucy said, next season, next summer, when there might be too much water in a winter or perhaps not enough in the summer. And the lack of long-term planning, joining those two things up. If I can put it this way, I've been on farms where soft fruit growers growing raspberries and blueberries are desperately frustrated because they want to grow more, but there's a lack of water availability in the summer. But conversely, I've also been welly deep in fields where crops are drowning in water because it's been around for too long in the winter.
Right.
So I guess this report's kind of re-emphasising to me that if we want to get flooding and water management right, farmers can get on with what they do best.
So can I just... Can I ask you then just to pick up on Lucy's point, where Lucy Munns said that it just goes to show the importance of storing water. In my opinion, it's a really, really good idea. We need to be able to store this water over winter. What are we getting wrong at the moment in terms of water storage?
So water storage that's currently invested on behalf of taxpayers by the government is done so for food for household, water for household consumption. We need to also see equal emphasis placed on water for growing food. I've seen those potato crops and onions in the east of the country that are withering in the summer months because they don't always get enough water. So we have to do more to mitigate the effects of more extreme weather patterns in order that we have a resilient food system.
One of the things that is clear from what you're saying, from what Lucy's saying, from what people like James Rebanks, the brilliant shepherd and farmer and author who we've spoken to on this programme, often say is that these sort of crises expose how exposed and how vulnerable our food system is. I know it's a big question in a short amount of time, but what do you and the NFU think we can do to make our food system more resilient? What's the immediate thing we need to do?
We at the NFU are really worried about the farm costs at the moment. So we have to find ways to alleviate the immediate rising costs of growing food. And that includes short-term measures where we could look at intervening on some of our biggest costs around fuel and fertilizer. But we must also look at our long-term ability to grow food. And look, if we're going to apply some farmer logic to this here, that also includes our ability to be able to store water in the winter and use it in the summer.
All right, Paul Tompkins, farmer in Yorkshire and Deputy President of the National Farmers Union, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
It's now a quarter to nine. Let's turn to somewhere where there are shortages, an island, Cuba. Spent most of the weekend without power from one end of the island to the other. The total collapse of the electricity grid came as the Trump administration's fuel blockade on the island is taking grip. No oil shipments have reached the country in 3 months. Some of the worst affected are the elderly, children, and many pregnant women in Cuba say they've received no state support and are frightened at the prospect of having a baby during blackouts. From Havana, Will Grant now reports.
As Washington shows no sign of letting up its near-total oil blockade on Cuba, most hospitals on the island have been plunged into darkness. Many are only accepting emergency cases. But the lights inside Havana's specialist maternity and neonatal hospital, the Ramon González Coro, have stayed on throughout the crisis. Little wonder when you meet one of its patients, Mauren Echevarria Peña. It's been a complicated pregnancy, as Mauren has had gestational diabetes and chronic hypertension. She has not left the maternity ward since the blockade began 3 months ago. Things have been tough, admits Mauren, with her doctors watching on. But here in the hospital, they've done everything they can for me. She says, though, that the rolling blackouts have her worried about the impending birth. Over the weekend, representatives of international solidarity movements, among them the leader of your party, Jeremy Corbyn, arrived in Havana under the banner Let Cuba Breathe. They brought with them aid donations, including for the González Coro Maternity Hospital.
When the President of the United States uses the colonial language of I will take it if I want, this is the same language that is used when it's on Palestine and Gaza. This is the same language.
In front of Cuba's ageing Politburo and President Miguel Díaz-Canel, they promised unwavering support to the revolution. Conditions for most ordinary Cubans remain near unbearable. And while Mauren says she's been well cared for during her difficult pregnancy, many of the other 32,000 pregnant women on the island say they've had to face these extremely challenging conditions with no tangible support from the state.
Hola.
Indira Martinez is one of them. 7 months pregnant, she invited me into her home in the middle of a power cut. With no working stove or fridge, her calorific intake has dropped significantly in the last few months of her pregnancy. Her husband is also worried about her stress levels.
I haven't received any of the humanitarian aid sent to Cuba. My husband and I didn't enter this pregnancy irresponsibly. We did it knowing that we can't rely on any help from the government. We just pray that everything works out okay.
Beyond the huge difficulties of being pregnant in the middle of a fuel blockade, Indira harbours real fears about the future for her baby girl.
¿Cómo le vas a explicar que no tiene perspectiva?
How am I going to tell her she has no prospect in life? Because she won't have any. As much as one would like, as a parent, to offer them a real life and motivate them, I have no basis to tell her that she has a future.
Among the international supporters in Havana was the Northern Irish rap group Kneecap. Cuba has an ageing population, a very low birth rate and huge outward migration. The island needs more young people to have children. But Mauren's baby boy, due in days, and maybe even Indira's baby girl, due in 2 months, will be born under a crippling fuel blockade. In effect, the hardest days in the island's modern history.
That was Will Grant reporting from Cuba. Time now is 11 minutes to 9. The AI giant Anthropic is in federal court today in a case that has potentially huge ramifications. Anthropic is suing the Pentagon after it labelled the company, which is based in San Francisco, a national security supply chain risk. That is a designation generally reserved for foreign adversaries. The Pentagon made that designation after Anthropic, an American-based firm, said it would refuse to let its AI tool, Claude, be used for mass surveillance or fully autonomous weapons. One reason this gets rather messy is that Anthropic's technology is part of the workflow within Maven. That's the AI decision support tool that US Central Command uses. Now, Microsoft, a major investor in and collaborator with Anthropic, has supported Anthropic in its battle with the Pentagon. A short time ago, I spoke to Professor Michael C. Horowitz. He's professor at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also a former deputy assistant secretary at the US Department of Defense. And I asked him whether Anthropic had legitimate concerns.
I think that this is really a disagreement about personalities masquerading as a dispute about real substance. Fundamentally, Anthropic and the Pentagon don't actually have any disagreements about the current projects that Anthropic is working on for the Pentagon. Everything that Claude is doing in the Middle East, for example, Anthropic is okay with, and the Pentagon's okay with. And the Pentagon and Anthropic don't actually have any disagreement about any future projects that they're working on. This is a theoretical dispute about potential future engagements that the Pentagon might ask Anthropic to work on.
But can I ask you then what you make of the principle that Anthropic says, and Dario Amodei, the boss of Anthropic, says is at stake here, which is the potential future use of their technology for mass surveillance, including of democratic citizens, or fully autonomous weapons. If that were to materialize, do you think that it's a legitimate concern for a company to have?
I mean, companies can make their own decisions about whether they want to work with the Pentagon. And so Anthropic is certainly correct that that is a thing that they should be that they should be thinking about. On the other hand, the Pentagon has a right to choose what vendors that it wants to work with and what terms of service that it wishes to accept from them. The thing about this that has seemed so senseless in some ways to me is that because there was no actual real dispute on the table, a thing that the Pentagon wanted Anthropic to do, it seemed like a thing that they could just try to figure out in the eaches instead of the way that this escalated. In theory, mass surveillance of U.S. citizens should already be off the table because that would violate the American Constitution. And the Pentagon's been very clear about that. And also in theory, the Pentagon's developed lots of different kinds of weapon systems, and Anthropic's objection to autonomous weapon systems seems less philosophical and more because they think their technology isn't ready yet. All of this seems like a thing that should have been worked out, except for the breakdown in trust between Anthropic's leadership and the Pentagon's leadership.
And given Anthropic is now suing the U.S. Defense Department, this is going to take a while to work through, isn't it? Because of the way that Anthropic's technology has become part of the workflow within Maven, the AI decision support tool that U.S. Central Command uses.
Absolutely. Anthropic's technology is now being used in the Middle East as one of the plugins to Maven's smart system as part of the U.S. War against Iran, along with Israel. That's one of the reasons why in the announcement of the supply chain designation that the Pentagon gave itself essentially 6 months to wean itself off of Anthropic's technology. It's an indication in some ways, like another indication of how senseless this is the actual warfighters in the Pentagon and deployed in the field are using Anthropic's technology now in the context of the war. So I think there's some hope that this 6 month period becomes a bargaining period to work things out. But Anthropic has filed in court to stop the supply chain designation at the very least. And who knows how long that will take.
And of course, what is happening with artificial intelligence, which has a kind of race dynamic around the world today, is part of a broader geopolitical struggle between America and its adversaries, and maybe principally China. What do you think Beijing will be making of this battle, knowing that Beijing, of course, has a much tighter grip on its technology companies than America seems to be able to have on its leading AI companies?
China's the real winner here. If a country like the United States is deprived of the talent and the technology of one of the leading companies of the world, like Anthropic, essentially because of what was a personality dispute between the leadership of the company and the leadership of the Pentagon, the country that wins the most is China, who, of course, is rapidly modernizing in all military arenas, including artificial intelligence, to compete with the United States and the West.
Professor Horowitz, thank you very, very much indeed for joining us on the Today program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Just to let you know that coming up on Radio 4 at 9:30 this morning, Inside Health talks to Michael Rosen about the grief of losing his son to meningitis. That's here on Radio 4. Now, the last few minutes of the programme, we're going to focus on the legacy of the work of the great Jane Goodall, who died last year at the age of 91. She once said, "Every single day you live, you make a difference in the world, and you get to choose the difference that you make." Last night, the winners of the first ever Jane Goodall Hope Awards were announced. The awards, which recognise recipients for their passion, courage and dedication to transforming the future for animals, people and the planet, were crucial for promoting not just the legacy of Jane, but the work of those who won. And we'll speak to one of the winners in just a second. First, though, a reminder of how Jane herself inspired so many with the work she did with chimpanzees. She was, of course, one of the Today programme's guest editors back in 2021.
You know, people were inspired by the chimpanzees, let's face it. It was a young girl out there with the chimpanzees. National Geographic picked up the story, put me on the cover. It kind of took the world by storm because it was completely unique at the time. And fortunately, I wasn't exactly bad-looking, let's put it that way.
Laughing with us here is one of the first winners of a Jane Goodall Hope Award. He joins us in the studio, Dr. Jill Robinson, who's founder and chief executive of the organisation Animals Asia. Good morning to you. Congratulations.
Good morning, Nick. Thank you.
And last night was as much about honouring her as it was people like you.
Oh, my gosh. It was a room full of love with everyone just coming together. And I think with a sense of purpose of how even more enthusiastically we can protect this suffering but very beautiful world. And I think Jane would have been so proud.
And you met her when she came to visit your work?
I've known Jane as a friend for about 20 years. She first came out to see our bear sanctuary and take part in a health check and of one of our previously caged bears, and she was just marvellously lifting everyone on site, as Jane always does.
Now, for those who don't know the horror of bears being caged in Asia, this is because their bile is used in traditional medicine.
Yes, in traditional medicine through very egregious means, and obviously they're kept in cages for their entire life, up to a lifespan of about 30 years. So, you know, Animals Asia, you know, our duty of care to those bears is to rescue as many as we can and keep them in our sanctuaries, both in China and Vietnam.
And you brought a photograph of one of them.
Oh, look at the lovely Hector. He's just so gorgeous. That's his best Hollywood pose there. And this is how they can recover, you know, from a lifetime of suffering.
And Hector was in a cage, was he?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. You know, they are literally at death's door.
And it's interesting, I hadn't realised this until I read up a little this morning, that part of Jane's legacy is giving animals like Hector a name, not a number.
Yes, that was, you know, from the very beginning, you know, when she started in the 60s. And it's something really, a legacy that that I've loved carrying on as well since the 90s. Every bear is not a number, but a name for us, even before they're formally adopted by supporters who give them a name.
So tell us the story, because it's a fascinating story of how a girl from here ends up being a woman running a bear sanctuary in Asia.
Oh, gosh. Well, I was in Hong Kong from the mid-80s there, and I was working in welfare, animal welfare, and a journalist friend of mine said that he'd just come back from a bear bar farm and I should go and see it. And I did. I grabbed a couple of friends. We went over into southern China and we walked onto a farm and saw bears in a sort of dungeon type area. And as I was walking around, I felt a bear touch my shoulder. And I turned around in shock because I realised I'd got too close to the cage. And there was a bear with her paw through the bars. And I did a stupid thing, but she didn't hurt me. She just squeezed my fingers. And she started everything about Animals Asia, where we are today.
That changed your life?
And it changed my whole life. And we've rescued 700 bears now over this time.
I began with the words of Jane Goodall herself: every single day you live, you make a difference in the world. Is that something we should remember when times are as tough as they are?
Oh, my gosh, completely. Because we can do everything from the smallest task, like turning off the tap when we clean our teeth, which saves, you know, millions and millions of gallons of water. Or we can work towards, you know, the process.